past explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, and why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. And the solar wind tonight is a light 448.6 kilometers per second at the moment. Those bluish-tinted clouds way up in space you see at night are noctilucent clouds, also known as NLCs when observed from the ground. They're also termed PMCs, or polo-mesospheric clouds, when observed from space. They exist right at the edge of space, about 50 miles up, and some scientists believe they are rocket exhaust, while others believe they are actually caused by global warming. NASA is going to try to find out exactly what they are later this year by launching the AIM satellite. That stands for Aeronomy of Ice in the Mesosphere. It's a 430-pound NASA-funded satellite that will orbit about 373 miles above Earth. We'll keep you posted on what they find from this study with three different types of detectors, including four cameras, which produce a process called occultation, which will provide a precise two-dimensional view of the ice crystals that should reveal their chemical composition. Very interesting stuff we'll keep you posted on. And don't forget to look for the planet Mercury just after sundown in the western sky in mid-June. Don't wait too long because it will set. With a telescope, it looks like a tiny half-moon. It's sort of pink with the naked eye. So check it out if your sky is clear and it doesn't take you away from tonight's broadcast. It will be visible for about half the month of June. If you want to stay current on our programs, guests, books, CDs, DVDs, and other outstanding stuff for your space, you can make X Squared Radio your favorite place on the web at x2-radio.com. We also want to welcome Global Star Radio Network and its satellite feed for X Squared Radio. This gives us an AM radio presence all across North and South America, live Sundays from 5 to 8 p.m. Eastern. And we appreciate the support of our producers at BBS Radio Network. And remember, if it's not mainstream, it's on BBS Radio. If you want to request that X Squared Radio be added to your local AM station live on Sunday evenings, please write us and give us the call letters of your local affiliate, and we'll see what we can do. One of the first things people notice about X Squared Radio is our format. We run our content for about 50 straight minutes at a time, allowing our guests to fully make their point without commercial interruptions. They also notice that our archives are free for the listening. That is by design. My intention is to grow the program into the highest quality scientific talk radio program on Earth by giving you access to the best guests, the best technology, and the most open discussion of the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth, free of any charge to the listener. I want to accomplish that by asking our affiliates and our sponsors to pay the bills and not you, the listener. If this is acceptable to you, then please, when you are ready to shop for cool stuff for your space, do it through X Squared Radio, and we'll continue to grow. Next week on X Squared Radio, we have Marco Rodin coming on the program. In addition to his outstanding achievements in mathematics, he is the inventor of the Rodin toroidal coil, and may be the first to propose a concrete method for man-made black holes. If you ever thought about hard science, being able to crack open the dimensions for galactic exploration, you need to be here next Sunday at 5. We're definitely going to get off in the mud of physics and math. And don't forget to visit our online store. We have added some of the best CDs on the planet for space fans. We also carry the books of our guests, so if you are listening to an archive and you want the books mentioned on the program, you can easily click into that area and pick up the book or DVD. You also want to sign up for our newsletter. We send out some really neat specials each month. This month we're adding some 3D software for exploring space that's free to anyone who visits the online store. Tonight, our guest is Tom Horn. Tom Horn is a former pastor, an exorcist, a national best-selling author of numerous books, including Ehrman's Gate. He is a researcher and a freelance writer whose Raiders News Update reports have been referred to by writers for the L.A. Times Syndicate, MSNBC, Christianity Today, Coast to Coast AM, WorldNet Daily, and dozens of news magazines and global press agencies. He has even been a national spokesperson for Louis Gossett Jr. and Judd Nelson. His DVD series called Psychotronic Warfare is among the must-see productions for all listeners of X Squared Radio. He is also, this Ehrman's Gate that he's just written is the VMI publisher's all-time best-selling title. We only have 3 hours, so let's please welcome Tom Horn. How are you tonight?
I'm doing fine, Brooke, and thank you for inviting me on your program.
Oh, no problem. It's definitely my pleasure. I think because we could spend hours and hours talking about the things you've written about, I think the best way to proceed is to maybe start with small things first. Let's try to discuss just the reality of UFOs existing. I think it's safe just to classify them into two categories for the purposes of this show. The first is a UFO that originates here on this planet, and the second is a UFO that has a point of origin somewhere out there. Of course, the official mainstream position is that they don't exist at all. So let's talk about the decision that they do or don't exist. Have you personally ever seen a UFO?
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up. You know, some years ago, my wife and I were driving across what they call the Shoals Mountain here outside of Newburgh, Oregon, and we were on our way to her mother's house. And I say some years ago, this was actually probably about 20 years ago. And as we were coming up over the crest of the Shoals Mountain, I caught something out of the corner of my eye, and at first I thought it was a reflection in the glass, the windshield of the vehicle, because it was shooting erratically back and forth across the windshield, so I thought it was just a light doing some kind of trickery. And I glanced at it, and I glanced at it again, and then as I looked at it more as I was driving, it started dawning on me that I was actually seeing something in the air, but I didn't have any idea what it was. About that same time, I noticed that my wife was looking at the same object, very high in the sky, but covering literally hundreds of miles of the sky, just in the blink of an eye, just barely leaving a trace behind it, and doing these very hard corner turns. So I pulled the car over, and we got out and stood there and watched it for about probably a full 60 seconds, and then suddenly it just shot out of space and it was gone. And we, of course, you know, we didn't think of it in terms of a UFO, other than the fact that it was in the sky, it was doing things that were simply beyond anything we could understand in terms of known technology. And but you know, we didn't know what we had seen, and so went to our parents' house. So we didn't mention it to our parents because we figured they'd think we were nuts. And but the next day we got up in the Statesman Journal, which is the largest newspaper in Salem, Oregon. It's the second largest newspaper in the state of Oregon. Had a news article where hundreds of people across Oregon and Washington had saw a UFO, and so we didn't realize we were part of a collective body who had seen something, of course, that to this day. And I've requested from the Statesman Journal through their archives if they could please look up that article and give me a copy of it, and I've never been able to get it from them.
Oh, how about that? Well, I think I've been driving late at night across the desert and seen things flash across the windshield and pulled over and got out, but never seen anything. And I've always wanted to see something, so I'm always fascinated when people, especially if it's a shared experience like you and your wife, have a UFO experience that's you know, really personal. I mean, did that affect you right then, or did it, you know, just sort of stick in your memory? Or
well, it amazed us. We were bewildered by it because both of us, it was a good thing both of us were there together to verify that we had both seen the same thing at the same time. And you know, I'm not a physicist. I understand that you are. So I mean, you can imagine standing there like we were, seeing something literally covering hundreds of miles of the sky in the blink of an eye, and stopping and doing these erratic hard turns, and then shooting back across the sky the other way, and then it was gone.
And then also without, you know, hearing a jet blast or sonic booms or anything like that.
No, we didn't hear anything like that or see anything else other than the fact that just whatever it was it looked to us like about the size of maybe a dime up in the sky. So, and at the height that it was in the sky, that might mean that it was very large. But whatever it was, it's been a mystery, other than the fact that, according to the Statesman Journal, hundreds of other people from Washington and Oregon had seen it at the same time. And, you know, I've seen things in my life that were mysterious and then later on could be explained. I remember as a young man, I walked out into a cornfield early in the morning. I was working for a farmer, and these beams of light came down out of the sky, and they were beautiful. They were blue and had these colors that were kind of swirling through them, but it looked literally like maybe a helicopter or something way, way up in the air was shooting these very powerful beams of light down. And they were just moving for no apparent reason, just randomly through this cornfield. And I was afraid. I was mystified. I'm walking through this cornfield, and this a farmer that I was working for at the time came walking by me, and he says, "Beautiful northern lights, huh?" So sometimes, you know, the things we see and our imagination takes off, but there really is a plausible explanation for it. But in this case, I've often thought back about what my wife and I saw on the Shoals Mountain that night, and it was certainly no explanation for it. Now, of course, in the history of my family, that was only one situation that might be connected to ufology. It was the only experience I ever had like that. But my interest in writing and some of my interest in research over the years, especially with regard to ufology, actually dates back to my childhood and some things that my dad and then my sisters and them went through.
Well, I've never seen one, but I'm convinced that they have and do exist. And that kind of brings me to your ideas on maybe why the official mainstream position is that they don't exist. You know, in my exploration of ancient civilizations, and my co-author's done much more than I have, but it seems that most record keepers had no problem recording interactions with off-worlders. Even the Bible lays down a perfectly clear story of at least five races interacting with one another before you even get out of Genesis. But in modern times, there's just no small amount of ridicule that accompanies any person's claim that they've seen a UFO, and especially if they have met an alien. So what's wrong with us?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, you look at, you mentioned the Bible, and this, of course, you know, my history is that I come from a biblical worldview. And if I can I set this up by just giving you a very brief story from my childhood?
Oh, of course.
When I was a child, my dad had returned from the Korean War and got a job as a cop in a little small town in Arizona called El Mirage, which is just across the Ogre Free River from Del Webb, Sun City, big retirement area. And but back then, there was just a great deal of desert in that area. And plus, my dad had grown up riding fence line for the Bard Ranch, so he knew the desert like the back of his hand. He loved to go hunting for mule deer. But he got back from the Korean War, got a job as a cop, later on became involved with the FBI and I think with the mob as well. But he had gone deer hunting, and he was up in the mountains, on horseback looking for deer, and come around a corner, and he suddenly approached these very large spherical cavities in the earth, perfectly spherical, almost like wells, except these were about 20 feet across and approximately maybe 8 to 10 or maybe even 12 feet deep. They were huge, and they were cut with such precision in the rock that Dad was just amazed by them. He'd never seen anything like it before. And these things had not been created with dynamite or anything like that, because the rock had not broke. These things had filled up full of water, and they were pooled full of water. And the deer were going down there trying to drink out of these things, and they'd slip and fall in. And every one of these holes had, half a dozen or more deer in them that were dead. And Dad stooped down next to one of them where there was actually a deer that was still alive there. And but he had never seen anything like it before, so he had a little camera with him. He took pictures of these holes. I still have pictures of them. I was on Coast to Coast recently and put one of those up online where people could go and look at it. It had a bunch of deer floating around in it. But he had never seen anything like it before, took these pictures, came back to the police department, got a hold of the Army Corps of Engineers, took a representative from the Army Corps of Engineers up there to show them these holes. They also didn't know how they were made, said it looked like some kind of an intense heat device had actually cut them into the ground. And the other thing was, they probably had appeared overnight, because the local native Indians that lived in the area didn't even know they were there. So they had appeared almost overnight. Here they are, 20 feet across, 8 or 10 feet deep. They're all lined up there on the top of this mountain. And so my dad called the Phoenix Gazette. The Phoenix Gazette went out there and took pictures of my dad kneeling down beside these holes with his 30-06 hunting rifle, and they wrote a story called Mysterious Mountain Holes. Now, by the way, that never was solved. The Army Corps of Engineers finally went up there and just dynamited the holes full of rocks so that the wildlife would quit falling into it and drowning. And then that seemed to be the end of the story, but then on November 5th, 1975, along the northeastern ridge of that mountain range, a guy by the name of Travis Walton stepped out of his pickup, and he said to look at a glowing object. Now, that's his report, and evidently had a crew of loggers that were with him, and they didn't want to approach this thing. He did approach it and said that he was blasted by a ray of inexplicable energy of some kind and was taken up inside the ship, and his companions who were with him took off afraid. Travis's story was that he was taken on board this spacecraft and subjected to a variety of different kind of physical examinations. In fact, his story, Fire in the Sky, was made into a motion picture, and was reported at that time, at least, to be what was considered to be one of the best documented accounts of a UFO abduction in history. Now, I said that to say this. I don't know if Travis's story was true. I also don't know, other than close proximity, whether there was a connection between the Walton UFO and what my dad had found in those mountain holes. But I do know this, that right after Dad made that discovery, and I was a younger man in those days, my aunt, who lived just right down the road from us, right next door almost, came to the house one day. Now, I learned this, Brooke, years later, doing research, trying to understand some of the stuff that was happening in our family, and I went back and I finally was able to get my mother, and then eventually my sister, to open up and to talk to me about what had been going on when we were kids. And I only found out then that it was shortly after Dad had made that discovery that my aunt, who lived a couple doors down, had come to our house one day afraid. In fact, my mom said that her face was ashen white, and afraid because she had saw something, a huge disc, according to her, that was hovering just above our house. And so I learned about that, but then I also knew from memory that it was also shortly after Dad had made that discovery that my sister had began having experiences. And these experiences included these small, what she called these little men, these little small gray men that would come. And one night she woke up actually screaming. In fact, it scared all of us so much we jumped out of bed and ran to her room. But all of that began happening. And without going into all of the details about that, what you have to understand is that, you know, we were just this old-fashioned Christian family. This whole phenomenon was not part of our worldview. It was not something we talked about. It was not something we entertained. In fact, you probably know, you know, growing up in a household like that, they were extremely strict. We didn't have a TV. We weren't allowed to read magazines like Gore or Fangoria or any of that stuff.
And there was no sci-fi channel.
There was no sci-fi channel. So there wasn't anything that could precondition this whole idea into either our heads or our worldview. It was just suddenly something that happened, and it introduced itself, whatever it was. It introduced itself to our family following those experiences. And since then, of course, additional research has led me back to understand that my dad was he was connected with different people on both sides of the curtain. And that, I think, is connected to this in some way.
Mm.
And I'll tell you another reason why I think that. I went on to become a pastor. I pastored for 25 years. I was also I eventually became the lead exorcist in a group of people that. And by the way, we were very selective. We were not anything like the evangelical exorcists that you see out there today that are casting demons of cotton balls out of people's closets. I mean, we didn't do any of that. We had a almost Catholic approach, although we weren't Catholics, but people who were submitted to us had to go through a whole litany of medical examinations, psychological evaluations. I mean, if they made it to us, they had gone even. In fact, one of the tests was there had to be a phenomenon which could not be explained, either objects moving about in a room, more than one voice at the same time emanating from an individual. There had to be something that couldn't be explained. So we did not perform very many exorcisms. But in any case, I was in that whole world for a long time, was studying to get my PhD. In the background, though, always remembering that this phenomenon occurred in our family when I was a boy and as I was growing up, and later on when I was able to go back and talk to my sister, I found out that it had continued to happen her entire life, off and on, the same phenomenon. And then I found out that it was happening with her daughter. Now, her daughter is a federal employee with Social Security Division, and she's opened up and began talking to me over the last few years about this phenomenon, and now I'm finding out that not only is it happening with her, it's happening with her daughter. So there's a generational situation that's going on there. But when I was pastoring, knowing that we had covered this up, maybe for different reasons, Brooke. I mean, we had gone to our pastors at that time, and they of course couldn't explain it at all. Just looked at it as being demon, demon possession or demonological, or dreams or nightmares or whatever. But they really didn't have any kind of answer for what it could be. And so as a family, we simply wouldn't talk about it. We didn't talk about it. And but when I was a pastor, it was always there, and I thought about it. And over the years, I began noticing that people all around the world were having experiences identical to what I knew we had covered up in my family.
Well, this generational exposure to UFOs, your sister and then her daughter, was it in the same geographical area, or had they moved away and it had followed them? Or
this followed them.
Wow.
This was there wherever they went. And so
it does sound like it was some kind of revisitation connection there. Maybe there's more to that story than we can cover tonight. But, you know, what do you think it will take to bring the human race to a firm understanding that we are not alone on this planet?
Well, I mean, I guess what I'm saying now is that, I came to understand, I think my family has come to understand, that there's more things in heaven and earth. I mean, there are things that are occurring which don't always conveniently fit into our little boxes. In the case with my niece, for instance, she was up in how do you explain this? She was, here she is, she's a woman who privately has experienced the same things that my sister experienced. Her, she too, keeping it very private, not talking about it. She's up in Washington just a few years ago with her husband and actually a group of people who went with them up there to see a Seattle Seahawks game. And they were standing up somewhere by the Space Needle. And this man and a woman dressed in military clothing came out of the crowd standing around there, walked right up to her and said, "Come with us, you've been selected." Well, obviously she wasn't going to go with them. She didn't even know who they were. And then they said, "Well, we're working with Steven Spielberg. We've got a booth set up over here across the road. We're promoting a new television series called Taken that's going to be coming out. And
I saw it.
And Spielberg has selected you to be part of the people that he's going to allow to go back behind this security fence. And so if you'll come with us, we're going to give you these different promotional materials and all that, and books and whatever." So she agreed to do it. She went there, and it was a huge group of people inside this tent that Spielberg had set up, and back behind that, a makeshift room that they had built, and there was guards at all this stuff. In fact, they had to had biometric devices of some kind that you had to use to get past certain doorways. But they took her inside there and eventually excluded her from some of the other crowd, took her in the back room, did a psychological evaluation. She was in there for several hours. They actually concluded that, in their opinion, she was an abductee.
She was the real deal.
She was the real deal. They let her see Spielberg's private collection of alien implants. I mean, but how do you explain that here's this woman that she's never talked about this stuff publicly, and that this has happened? How do you draw somebody like that out of the crowd? I mean, it after a while, it almost feels metaphysical. It feels like there's something much deeper that we can't quite put our finger on.
We'll get into that in the later portion of the show. But
right.
Let's talk about point of origin. Do you think that there are UFOs that have been home built and have or are operating on the Earth right now?
Well, I think that there are certainly things that are black budget. I think it's possible that things have been recovered. I had the opportunity of interviewing Colonel Jesse Marcel Jr. Recently. I'm going to be interviewing him again on the Q Files, but I met with him this time over in Mac, and we just sat down and took a recorder, and I talked to him about what was going on in 1947. I tried to approach it from a critical analysis and ask him if his dad could have been mistaken, if these could have been mogul balloons, if this could have been some other kind of crash debris, a weather balloon or Operation Paperclip, some kind of a Nazi experiment. And he really stuck to his guns. And the thing about Jesse was he impressed me as being a man who was entirely honest. I mean, he wasn't trying to add to anything, but he was very convinced that whatever his dad had brought into their house that night and laid out there on the kitchen floor, and that him and his mom had handled and looked at, that this was something that was not of this earth. And he believes that to this day. Of course, since then, he's also had opportunity to be in communication with other persons who could verify some of what his suspicions were. And But the point, to answer your question, is that, you know, my first approach to it was, I don't know what happened there, and of course I'm talking to the one guy on the planet alive who actually handled that debris, other than wherever the debris may be stored today. Could some of it have been back engineered, or could it have been indeed some kind of black budget operation that the government was working on, anti-gravity experiments or something like that, and that it crashed there? But I know that in the real world, obviously some of the different airplanes, cloaking devices and stuff that we've been working on, laser technology, things like that, they tend to be hidden in these black budgets and SAPOC budgets, stuff that's beyond congressional review. They're back there working on it sometimes for decades, you know, before it's ever revealed to the public. So I've often thought that with UFOs that you have several things happening. One, you have my Northern Lights situation, where something that's just natural has occurred, but our imagination takes over. I think you also have something that could be being worked on by the government, and it's covered up. These triangular shaped craft, for instance, could be some kind of vessels that the U.S. or other governments of the world may be working on, a collaboration, something like that. I think sometimes it's planets, Venus, natural gas, swamp gas, who knows. But then there is that other unexplainable. And that's of course, where both religious and non-religious researchers in this field have come to understand that whatever's going on with ufology, there is that one part that can't be explained. And every study, whether it's government-funded, private-funded, or just individual researchers like me out there scratching their head and trying to peel back the veneer so they can see beneath the, you know, see through the veil. Your guest is coming on next week, maybe, who's talking about manufacturing black holes. Maybe he's got his finger on a methodology for.
You know, even 10 years ago in the physics community, there were maybe a small minority that held some hope that UFOs were real, or that there is a way to travel intergalactically, or maybe even interdimensionally. But now, you know, in the last 10 years, the leaders, the most outspoken of us, the most published of us, are almost openly talking about parallel universes, alternate dimensions, trans-dimensional travel. It mathematically is possible, and I know that the mother of all black funding seems to be the military, and I noticed that we're constantly at war, at least the last 10 or 15 years we have been. And if the U.S. or a group of nations do possess this kind of technology, I wonder how it's being used, and, you know, why we don't see it on the national news when these precision operations take place. We just sort of say, well, we sent in an F-16, and although no one saw one. You think there's a new form of energy that it takes to drive these craft, or do you think it's something conventional, something natural that we know about?
Well, there again, I think part of what we're seeing, I mean, when we see it with our eyes and it appears to us to be some kind of empirical evidence of something, we're trying to put our finger on the technology. We may be thinking of it too much in exoteric as well as, and not as much in esoteric methods.
Well, I know when something makes a left-hand turn at 10,000 miles an hour, usually the occupants are smashed up against the driver's glass.
In the kind of traditional physics that we understand.
Right, yeah, exactly.
But, you know, that's like when my niece came back from Seattle, Washington, and she's all hyped up and telling me about this story of Steven Spielberg's people coming out, and she actually gave me the stuff that they gave to her and drew pictures of me of the alien implants and stuff that Spielberg has collected. She was all excited about it until a few days later she was up at night on her computer, and I'm a real low-tech guy, so you'll have to just forgive me for not being able to explain this correctly, but she's on her computer, and as she's talking, her computer has a camera of some sorts that streams these pictures back and forth so that the people that are talking to her see a picture of her and she sees a picture of them, and her program captures a picture of herself that's being sent across her computer. It's down in the right-hand corner of her computer.
Mm-hmm.
She's talking to these people. She's up late at night. Well, all of a sudden, this picture pops up on her computer, and lo and behold, there's an entity, what appears to be an alien gray standing right behind her. I know that sounds fantastic, but she captured the picture and she sent it to me. And I got to tell you, it looks to me like there's a three-dimensional being. She spun around. There wasn't anything there, but she sent it to me and said, you know, because my family still views me as this spiritual guy, you know, pray for me, help. What's going on, you know? And I sent the picture over to Stan Deo, because I know Deo's he's an expert in terms of interpreting photographs. And I said, you know, what is this? Is this fake? Is this real? Am I seeing things? And Stan did an analysis of the photo and sent it back to me, and he said, well, first of all, the photo is not a fake. Whatever's there is real. He said it could be that it is some kind of light just reflecting off of something, and just in this one picture alone had the astounding propensity of creating what appeared to be a three-dimensional form. Maybe it's just a trick of light. So I sent it to a friend of mine who has top secret security clearance, and ask him about it, and he said, well, he said Stan might be correct, but he said ask him if he's familiar with the model that says that multidimensionals could certainly employ a method of manipulating light photons, or I'm not a physicist, but he had a way of explaining how they could do that to create a holographic image of themselves or a three-dimensional form, maybe by overlaying these light photons against their dimensional membranes or something like that. So I sent it over to him. By the way, I happened to mention that when I was on Coast to Coast, and I put that picture up as well. I had two other photo experts, the kind of guys that like to crash the claims made by people on radio programs. But both of them sent me their analysis, and they said, son of a gun, if whatever's there is not real. And one of them said, not only is it not real, it's not light reflecting off of anything. It's a three-dimensional form. And not only that, he said, I can see its fingers. And he went into great detail as far as analyzing that. But so what kind of technology would it take for something to not be there, a moment later to be there, a moment later to be gone? I don't know, but I know that, you know, like in that case, maybe that was holography. Maybe it was nothing. Maybe it was a trick of light, as Dan Dale suggested that it might be. But I know that improvements in our understanding of general relativity, things like that, have been being talked about a lot lately. And it's causing, you know, the researchers like me and other people to believe that, for want of a better term, Stargate manipulators could be appearing and disappearing through, maybe it's traversable wormholes. Alan Holt was the guy, you know, that defined field reconnaissance space-time tunneling back in the 70s. And what today we talk about is wormholes or stargates. You know, the whole idea that maybe there's these hyperspace tunnels that connect these remote regions of the universe, and that people, persons that are millions of years in advance of us, have learned to manipulate that technology. That's not so difficult to believe if you think how young we are as a species, and that we're already at a point where we're starting, at least in terms of theory, to understand how that could be done in believable theory. I mean, science, if we could control it, we could do it. It's believable science. It works within the perimeters of what we understand.
Well,
maybe it's not even that. Maybe it's dimensions.
Not very many years ago, and I'm thinking it was 1999, gravity is one of the key players when you're talking about wormholes. They have to be held open by exotic material, which is very dense and can manipulate gravitational fields. So a group of scientists got together and decided how little gravity they could actually measure. Now, we're not talking about electrostatic attraction or electromagnetism. And they actually got down to a minimum distance of 0.1 millimeter. That's as close as they could get. And then once that distance was crossed, gravity was undetectable. So from that, they drew a conclusion, which is pretty mathematically sound, that there could be entire dimensions 0.1 millimeter wide, which in physical terms is a universe, when we would not be able to detect it in any way. And any being or mass could slip between those dimensions undetected. So here's what's on the table for UFOs that may originate from somewhere out there. Unless there is a fully developed race of beings that live on the moon or, you know, under the sea or something, or around the planets in our solar system, it seems highly improbable that someone would crawl into a metal can and travel across the cosmos to Earth. I mean, there are lots of reasons why they couldn't do this. Even at light speed, it would take years and years and possibly, you know, hundreds of decades to reach Earth, even if you knew exactly where you were going. You know, how do you think craft can move across space and time? And that kind of brings us to the central theme of your publications. And we're going to ask you straight out, what's a stargate?
Well, to me, a stargate, I use the term very loosely. And once again, I want to make sure that anybody listening to this broadcast understands that I make no claims of being an expert in any kind of science. I'm not. I was a pastor. I was for a short while involved as an exorcist. I tend to look at things in more of a metaphysical or esoteric way. I am studious. I have read. I try to understand the mechanics, for want of a better term, if we're looking at Stargate technology in the sense of manipulating wormholes. That, you know, that could be something that's carrying, when you talk about climbing into a metal can and push a button, a bunch of fire comes out the back like these old television programs traveling across vast measures of space, is not very believable in terms of today's science. In fact, I'm actually excited about today's science because it's starting to make more sense. It's starting to become more believable that weather, we're talking about traveling from different points, from remote regions of the universe, or whether we're talking about different dimensions, or maybe even different moments in time. That's a mind blower.
Mm-hmm.
That UFOs, whatever that means, could hypothetically be traveling through these space-time tunnels.
Well, that opens a lot of paradoxes, and we'll talk about that too, maybe. So do you think a Stargate is like a little black hole, or
well, but I guess what I was saying is that to me there is that side of it, and I read Dr. Eric Davis, if I'm saying his name correctly, from MUFON a few years ago, his presentation about how wormholes would work, you know, that and I know that he talked about how the craft could either come through them or even just use them as a like a window. Through which they could watch us, if you understand what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Or project an image, or even walk through.
Right. So I know that in that sense, wormholes, the Stargates, could explain some of the observations by eyewitnesses, and maybe even explain some of the phenomenon. You talked about earlier that what my wife and I had seen had not been accompanied with any kind of sounds or anything like that. But I know that in some cases, people who have witnessed UFO experiences, close encounters of various kinds, sometimes it's been accompanied with booming sounds, kind of like those unexplainable ones out there over the Pacific Ocean recently. And that could go along with more the technological idea of wormholes, the stargates opening and closing, and you as a physicist could explain that. I couldn't, but I mean, I understand the idea behind it.
Theoretically, there because of the speed with which things are moving between dimensions, or maybe even between universes, there's a phenomenon called vacuum fluctuations, where actually energy transfers between the two worlds. And I know it gets a little confusing because things actually arrive before they leave because of the difference in the speed of light in this reality and that reality. But there can be severe, audible transfers of energy. That's what's expected.
And so maybe Stargates means the manipulation of these wormholes. But maybe Stargates is either or both, in that it may also include something, for want of a better term, that we might look at as being mystical. Hot spots, sacred locations, where pathways exist through which perhaps these unknown intelligences are entering and exiting our three-dimensional reality.
Sort of like a specific electromagnetic coordinate points.
Yes, I mean, the one thing that we do pick up through research, and there again, both secular and religious researchers, although I got to tell you, I'm in a very small camp out here in terms of the guys with a biblical worldview who are studying this phenomenon. I happen to believe the phenomenon is real, and therefore it's a challenge to try to study to understand from my interests. And since I'm not qualified as a scientist, I don't rarely tend to look at it that way. But I wrote an online series for RaidersNewsUpdate.com called Stargates, Ancient Rituals, and Those Invited Through the Portal. And I wanted to just simply go back and make the case that from the beginning of recorded history, there is a phenomenon which has existed, a story that is told in all of the mythos of all of the ancient civilizations, of every great civilization, of the gods who came down. And they came through something, and they involved themselves with the human species. So that for me, in addition to any theoretical scientific idea about wormholes or stargates or portals, there is this rich history of these ancient myths, this folklore.
Sure, and what's not said is almost as important as what is said. I mean, when you look at the documents, the Bible not excluded, there's no mention of, you know, silver spaceships lining up on the seashore. These beings just sort of appear and have their interactions, and some of it's quite lengthy, hundreds of years in some locations, and then disappear again.
Well, that and but there is also this iconography, these ancient flying discs, you know.
Sure.
Sumerian engravings on clay cylinders talking about flying discs, and similar winged disc being found in Assyrian mythology, associated with Asher, the flying god of war. And the Egyptians talking about Ra navigating the heavens in his flying boat. And so there is something that identifies with our modern eyewitness accounts of that seems to be identical to what we're seeing today in terms of ufology. But because, and some people refer to these as cargo cults, you know, because the ancients referred to these as the gods, and because I'm a religious man, I have an interest in trying to both look at it, study it, and reconcile it with my own personal beliefs, while at the same time not going out of my way to insult anybody who might not agree with me, if you understand what I mean.
Sure.
But so that it's comfortable to me to try to understand it, to try to make a sense out of it, and to try to make sense with what was going on, is going on, with some of the female members of my family. There's something there that is a phenomenon, and I want to put my finger on it. I guess I'm Curious George. I don't want to be the cat, you know, whose curiosity got him killed, but I do want to try to understand what is it that's coming through these gateways, and both in mythology and now more and more in science, we're starting to understand these gateways of heaven and earth, and even of the rivers and seas that from Sumerian deity descriptions all the way up to modern ufology and everything in between, something's going on. It's an event, something that actually could be looked at as evidence for something one might call documentation, you know, of a genuine historical, possibly supernatural event that tends to change the lives of some of those who are impacted by it. I mean, think about this. Almost instantly, populations from around the world went from being hunter-gatherers to forming these advanced civilizations. And I'm sure listening to a program like yours, probably most of your listeners have thought of this over and over many times. There's nothing new in that statement. But for that one person out there, this might be the first time they're listening to this program, think about that. Ancients went from beating plowshares, and all of a sudden they're mastering these complicated mathematics and astronomy and science and engineering techniques
and husbandry. I mean, they're learning to domesticate animals and to breed different crops for edibility and to master medicines and astronomy. All of this bursts on the scene about the same time in various places around the planet. But that being said, even if there was interaction, and I guess for purposes of this program, we'll assume there was, in those days, and I mean all the way up to the point of maybe the 1700s, man would have deified such contact. But in these modern times, and I don't mean to be, you know, proud about it or anything, but we would not deify such contact. We would recognize it for what it is. This is another civilization that lives on another world or another dimension or another portion of our planet where they've enjoyed a highly advanced lifestyle different from ours. But we would not bow down and worship. We would not gather tithing. We would not, you know, cast our virgins at its feet. We would open dialogue and begin trading with it.
Well, let me tell you what's going on, Brooke, and from the people that I talk to in the circle that I walk in. First of all, you know, you have these ancients. They're doing all the things that we just said. They're cave people or whatever they are, you know, and suddenly their evolution is accelerated overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're building these observatories. And I know you said, you know, there could be this cross-communication. Maybe there was, but, I mean, things of similar pyramidal structures, all this astounding similarity and these astronomical pieces of information turning up in cave drawings and stuff all around the world. But because they're being painted on cave walls in crude, rudimentary ways, it appears that these were people who were writing down something they saw and witnessed of others who were super intelligent, of others who were beyond them. In other words, the record seems to be that people of lesser intelligence saw something from those of astounding intelligence.
Yes, indeed.
And so now you have all of the well-developed societies that at least had some method for writing down, for communicating, had some kind of language. Now they're setting these sacred records of this awakening period, this starting phenomenon, if you will, that are being written down by the cargo cults, the holy men, who are concerning themselves with what and who had suddenly descended through these gates of heaven and involved themselves with all of these antediluvians. But now, the question of whether beings of unknown origin are doing the same thing today. Now, would we interpret that today if all of a sudden, we had this Independence Day size craft that just suddenly appears over Washington, D.C. or New York City? How would that impact the human race? How would that impact our sense, everything from our sense of religious worldview to our economics, military policy, the little things that we people tend to care about, our control of our part of the planet, or maybe our domination of other parts of the planet? How would all of that just suddenly be threatened in a way that it would stop us in our tracks? It could collapse overnight the economies of the world. That's what the government worries about.
Well, I think
that's part
study,
of what the government worries about.
There was a study put out by the Brookings Institution that revealing the existence of alien civilizations or technology would cause just that kind of collapse. But I think even with the media, not only books but movies and radio programs, and the sophistication with which we transfer technology so rapidly around our planet, I don't think there would be a collapse. I don't even think really the religious world would collapse, because the existence of other races other than human in the universe, in most people's minds, would not change their view of God at all.
Well, when I talked to Jesse Marcel a few days ago, and he's a Roman Catholic, and I asked him, I said, now, Jesse, I talked to him about some stuff off the record, too, with Amato and some of the conversations he had at the Capitol building with different people, their aides to different congressmen. And but on the record, I asked him about that whole question. And, of course, I may have even known a little bit more about what was coming out of the Vatican than he did, because that's where I happen to live. That's what I happen to study.
Sure.
But for him, this wouldn't challenge his ideas of God. It wouldn't challenge his cosmology at all. He already believes that in terms of both science and mathematics, it only makes sense. In fact, the interview I did, he's talking about the number of bodies, celestial bodies, being like the sands of the sea, and that it was, in his opinion, ridiculous to think that in all of that the Creator never made anything more than what's on this planet. But I can tell you this, that in the Vatican now, I mean, the question of whether these beings are interacting with the human species right now, and maybe even in preparation of that big OD, that big official disclosure when the Pope and various representatives of the governments of the world walk out into the well of the United Nations and say, ladies and gentlemen, we have an announcement to make, we're in contact. I can tell you that in the Vatican, I mean, there, over the last year, increasingly, they've been convinced that something unexplainable not only has happened in the past, but it's going to happen again. And if you look at their publications, and I'm talking about official publications, stuff that's been coming out now over the last 12 months, being published by owned publishing houses of the Vatican, Guy Cosmenolgo's Intelligent Life in the Universe, notwithstanding, and some of the others, and they're saying literally now that there is a greater than not possibility of imminent extraterrestrial contact, and they're busy preparing those members of the Catholic Church not to be threatened by it. They're going out of their way to say our theology can embrace this, that this is maybe these are even intelligent life forms that could be evangelized by the Church, but that in any case, it's not something that threatens to collapse the Catholic way of life. And so, certainly, whether you agree with that or you don't agree with it, the Vatican is, probably the largest representative body, at least of the Christian community in the world, and certainly will be a voice if such a thing as official disclosure happens.
Well, I don't know how to put this into words, because I'm going to talk about my feelings, but I don't have any data to prove this, but over my lifetime, it seems like the intensity of awareness of almost like an impending event that's going to occur. It's difficult for me to put into words, but I personally call it global first contact, that, you know, coming down into the well of the UN and saying, ladies and gentlemen, I want to introduce to you an ambassador from another planet. Please hear him. That is I feel like it's going to happen maybe in the next 4 years. In fact, I write that, but in 5 years may go by and I may look back on that and regret I ever said it, but I don't feel as though I will. And even in my interviewing of people on the street for our books and for our next book, I talk to ordinary people who have no scientific training. They're not big sci-fi fans. They don't even watch a lot of television. But you ask them if they feel like we're getting close to some kind of extra human contact, and they all say yes, every one of them. It's amazing. So there is a metaphysical level to this as well, it appears. That you don't necessarily have to have a UFO experience or have aliens stopping by your house every 90 days, but there is a feeling, even in the inner cities, even in the countryside where I live, there's a feeling that something is about to happen. Some kind of communication is going on a level that just boggles my mind. It's so global, I can't even put it into words. Do you feel that same thing?
Well, certainly, and not to stay on this whole idea of metaphysics the whole night, but I mean, that's also the conclusion of secular ufologists, you know, people who are researchers that have no particular spiritual worldview. They're just looking at the data and trying to interpret it, both historical and not as often tangible data. Ufologists from different disciplines, like Dr. John Mack, you know, he wrote about alien beings that appeared. In fact, he talked about it. What's interesting, both in terms of metaphysics and also in terms of Stargate technology, talked about them coming to the sky through these openings and these strange spacecraft. But in his mind, it presented this a challenge, because he said they seem to partake of properties belonging both to the spirit and the material world. And Jacques Vallée has a strong similarity in all of his writings. I mean, if you read his books, Confrontations, if you read Passport to Mongolia, this whole idea that the contact with these beings, at least up until this moment, it just seems to be a modern extension of the age-old tradition of contact with non-human consciousnesses, like angels and demons and elves and sieves, good and bad. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in Abduction, Mac made a really interesting statement that I probably am going to use in the new version of my Stargate series that's being turned into a book, in which he said that a lot of the abductees that he had spoke to, it was their sense that at least in some of their experiences, it wasn't even occurring within the physical space-time dimension of the universe as we might comprehend it, because they were talking about these beings breaking through from another dimension, and they actually use terms like slit or crack in a barrier, a gateway, a portal, as if they were entering into our reality beyond some kind of a veil. Mm. So there is, I mean, there is something there. In fact, I think you could even go back. I don't like to quote these guys that are, you know, that mingle with the dark arts, but you could even go back to guys like Aleister Crowley, who was trying to bring something through a dimensional vortex or a gateway, and eventually he says that he did, and he draws this being called Lamb, which appears to be very close to a similar depiction of the classical alien greys. And then, of course, and this is not an area that I really get involved with, but I know there are other researchers who compare this whole phenomenon of interaction with these beings to both angelology and demonology, in the sense that some of them appear to be malevolent while others don't.
Sure. And it's difficult to tell if there's a perfect balance or not, or if time is switching back and forth between them. It's just, or if they're warring with one another, or what they're actually after. But anyway, we're finishing up our first hour. Tom Horn is my guest, and his book is Ehrman's Gate. And when we come back, we'll tell you how to get that book, and we will cover some more details. Anyway, I'm Brooks Agnew, and we'll slip away for about 5 minutes of commercials, and we'll be right back. Some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Did you know that 11 of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon were made by Eagle Scouts? It's true. Soon, men and women will be doing the real moonwalk. But just so we don't forget, the first footprint on the moon has been replicated in a limited edition plaque that would make the perfect gift for a court of honor. Maybe you need something special for your office or your library at home. This high-quality plaque can add that something special that lets people know how excited you are we are returning to the moon. Visit Countdown Creations at X Squared Radio today and order your limited edition First Step on the Moon plaque. Brooks Agnew here, author of The Ark of Millions of Years. You know we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service, so you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have neat gifts for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. If you like wildlife art and would love to add some of the most beautiful replicas to your home or office, you should visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio. They have everything from pandas to fish to eagles to horses in all sizes and price ranges. No matter what animal you love, they have the art for you. So visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio for that special someone today. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. My guest tonight is Tom Horn. Hey, I wanted to take this opportunity to also let you know that you can call in if from anywhere on the planet, toll-free, 877-876-5227, 877-876-5227. That's also posted on the website, either at BBS Radio or X Squared Radio from wherever you're listening. I wanted to take this to the next level. Let's talk about the actual races that have come to Earth. Your book, Ehrman's Gate. I know it's billed as a fiction story, but it's a spine tingling story of interaction between Earth and one or more alien races using a stargate. So, tell us a little bit about your book and how to get it.
Well, it was maybe 10 or 12 years ago, I actually, what got me on this, Brooke, was that I started noticing the rapid advancement of this funding of certain emerging sciences, and in particular those related to cloning and transgenics. And as you know, I have an online news service, which has astonished me in terms of its growth. I guess we're up to about 400,000 or 500,000 people a day. We reach tens of millions of people a month now, so I'm happy about that.
Oh, my goodness.
But that's put increasing pressure on us, of course, to stay on the cutting edge in terms of reporting the news. And we have decided a long time ago that we wanted to do what other people did not do. We wanted to be positive, but we wanted to be on the edge. We wanted to cover the stuff that most people would just avoid. But on the other hand, we wanted this to be reputable news sources. We weren't going for weekly world news, if you get my drift. So, I mean, it really, what it did was, eventually it created for us something that up until now, I don't think anybody else on the Internet's even doing, and that might go to why we have the numbers. It's kind of your radio program in print, if you know what I mean. So, as a result of that, you know, we're searching the different government databases, and we're trying to find news stories, little pieces of legislation information, where are federal research grants being made, things like that. And one year, I noticed that fully one-fourth of all research grants from the government were going to go to transgenic science, and I thought, wow, this is a huge amount of money. And I know in theory what the term transgenics means, but how does that apply to what we're actually doing in terms of funding research? What are we trying to accomplish? So I started doing some investigative research into transgenics, not so much cloning as I was transgenics, and found that I was surprised that other people out there in the faith community were not talking about this. They were not talking.
Well, help me out a little bit. What is transgenics?
Well, if you read the book, The Ehrman Gate, you find out that, first of all, we take reproductive cloning, which is that type of cloning that was used by the people that generated Dolly the Sheep, mm-hmm. reproductive cloning, somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning. And that's the kind of cloning we start out with. But transgenics takes cloning a step further. Whereas in, like, somatic cell nuclear transfer, the scientist can take the genetic material from the nucleus of a donor adult cell to an egg whose nucleus, and therefore its genetic material has been removed, and that recombined or recombinant cloning, that recombined egg now containing the DNA from the donor cell, is either treated with chemicals or a mild electrical shock. That's the form of science we used in our book, The Armand Gate, to try to jumpstart cell division. And so the thing starts growing, and the clone reaches, you know, two cells, then four, and so on. Finally, when it gets to a certain suitable stage, it's transferred into the uterus of a female host, where then it would continue to grow until birth. Now, that's,
yeah, we're very familiar with that.
Okay, you're very familiar with that. But with transgenics, it's possible to take all of that a step further in that you can introduce the gene or genes from one species into the cellular DNA of another species. The gene or genes, let's say, in a worst-case scenario, of a snake, is inserted into the fertilized egg of a woman and becomes integrated into the DNA of her embryo, and now, hypothetically, you have a snake human that's that's growing. You have a chimera that's being created through that theoretical application. By the way, some of the publicly known experiments, though, with transgenics, including human genes, are, for instance, cancer genes that are being inserted into the embryos of research mice. And those transgenic mice then are being used to test different kind of drug therapies to see that, you know, if they might be effective on humans with cancer.
I had a paper posted on the website a while back where hair color could genetically be changed. In other words, if you were a blonde and you wanted to become a brunette, you could literally just take gene therapy and change your hair color.
Well, gene therapy is, you know, it's not really what I talk about, but there's obviously some good that could come out of a lot of this science. I'm not so much opposed to advances in science in this field as I am feeling that there needs to be ethical guidelines that are drawn up to make sure that there are certain boundaries over which we don't pass.
We don't create humans with gills.
Well, that's exactly right, and so that's kind of where I go in the Armand Gate. I do that on purpose because back when I started doing the research for this book, I wasn't even researching it to be a book. I mean, I was just doing the research. I wanted to understand why we were funding this at 25% of my money, and you know, what is it that I'm doing? What is it that I'm supporting? You know, here, and or at least in terms of the amount of money coming through those research grants. And so I started looking at, you know, the whole science. What are the ethics that might be raised by this? What are some of the philosophical questions that might be raised by some of the worst-case scenarios of transgenic science and these other related emerging sciences that could lead to transhumanism? And I wrote a couple of editorials, and one of the editorials that I wrote for RaidersNewsUpdate.com, Cal Thomas, the syndicated columnist for the L.A. Times and, you know, over there on CNN's Crossfire. He actually picked it up, and then he emailed me and told me that, you know, one of the editorials that I had written was astounding to him. He didn't even realize that this was going on. He was very apocalyptic about it. But then shortly after that, I was on the radio with Stan Monteith and Radio Liberty, and I was talking to Monteith about something, I don't remember what, but I asked him on that show, because knowing that he was a former medical doctor, I wanted to know what he thought, you know, about the implications of transgenics and transhumanism. And he surprised me in that he actually started to cry on the show. It bothered him so much, and he had been to a couple of different conferences. He still goes to these conferences as a retired medical doctor. And so I thought, you know, I come off that show and I thought, well, you know, somebody really ought to write something. I mean, there ought to be somebody who's taking a hard look at this science, and if for no other reason, maybe just raising it to the public consciousness so that out of that there could be a debate about ethics. And so I ran into an old college professor friend of mine, and I was at a conference, and I was telling him about this idea that I had for this book. Excuse me. And he said to me, he said, well, you know, he said, nowadays, Tom, he said, if you're gonna write a book, you don't write it like you wrote your first couple of books, because this was his opinion, by the way. But he said, nowadays, the broad populace are not too interested in reading academic books. If you want to read most people, if you want to reach them, write a book of fiction, and then take whatever the subject matter is, whatever your ideas are, your whole ethics issues, whatever those are. He said, take those and kind of weave them into the storyline so that you raise consciousness about it.
Yeah, a la Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, and so that was his idea. And by the way, I think we're swinging back around now. I think more and more now people will be more interested as well as reading and just academic. But that was his idea back then. That was maybe 8 years ago now. And so I started looking at writing the Ahriman Gate from that point of view, thinking that that this whole issue of transgenics and how it could be leading to transhumanism. And if we're talking about the blending of species, if we're talking about altering the human genetic code, then these are things that I think ought to be discovered, ought to be talked about. Excuse me.
Well, what in your book, what sort of off-worlders would build such a Stargate and then dial in Earth as a destination?
Well, a Stargate could be many things. A portal could be many things. In fact, a person, potentially, when you talk about re-engineering an individual, maybe that's part of the historical context. Maybe that's part of the story. I heard a commercial while we were on the break advertising, I think, one of your books talking about how the Watchers returned.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that a kind of transgenics, and that's why I took this science and put it in this piece of fiction, but talked about it in terms of both what it might have meant historically and what it could mean either in futurism or prophetically. I think something like that was actually happening in ancient times. There again, my conclusions are primarily based on the history, the stories from different civilizations that speak of a time when the gods came down and they mingled their species with the human race. And for some reason, the story seems to indicate that whole experience required some need for the blending of various species in order to create this pathway, this portal, this stargate through which they could extend themselves into the material world. Now, stargates, more perfectly might refer to the manipulation of wormholes, but I go beyond that to talking simply about portals, pathways through which multidimensionals could extend themselves into our three-dimensional reality. And there again, when you look at what even modern researchers like Vale and Keel and guys like that have found, there's this connection between what the ancient Watchers were doing and what modern abduction phenomenon seems to include. The fact that there's this need for vital energy, molecular energy associated with three-dimensional life forms, that somehow seems to be required as kind of a construct material for achieving incarnation by other dimensional beings. And here's a thought for you, Brooke. If the Creator alone possesses the power to speak, whatever that means, Haya, Hebrew, let there be, and raw atomic or nuclear energy is collected into various different kinds of molecular form, and it becomes created living energy, specific living creation. After the fact, however, it seems that whoever these others are, now in the Hebrew you can go, you can go into that angelic assembly that helped God in the creation, all of that. But whoever those are, they seem to be able to manipulate this molecular energy, and the story that is redundantly told through the mythos of many different cultures is that it constructed this, either a pathway or it formed for them some kind of three-dimensional expression. And a lot of the secular researchers say that's why animals and sometimes humans are either vanished altogether or killed and mutilated in these UFO flap areas. Now, in the case of the Watchers of the Book of Enoch, the term that you use, and you and I may probably have various ways of looking at that, but that whole story from the Old Testament includes this use of vital energy as kind of a material for forming a dimensional pathway. It appears to somehow have included both animals and humans, and that's why the transgenic side of this interests me, because in Enoch's very basic language, he says that these Watchers, these super intelligences, in his term, sinned. against the animal kingdom as well as the human kingdom. And so when I looked at that, I asked myself the question, if the only reason that the watchers were involving themselves with women was because of their beauty, what was this blending, what was this simultaneous activity with the blending of animal DNA and human DNA all about? What was that about? Now, in my mind, it could be that from purely a spiritual or metaphysical point of view, that the creation of humans by God was ta'ud in the Hebrew. They are ta'ud. It's exactly what I want. God creates man, he stands back and he says, it is very good, it is ta'ud. It is a vessel that can be an accommodator of my Holy Spirit. New Testament, know ye not, you are temples of the Holy Spirit, mm-hmm. something into which God can reside. But when the watchers came down, maybe it was necessary to alter at the genetic level this human creation so that instead of being potential vessels of the Holy Spirit, now they become vessels for something else, maybe rebel spirits as
I
far
see.
As...
So they are, at least in some respect, disembodied. That is to say, the three-dimensional expression of God, which we call humanity, is something they don't have, but they want to be part of.
Well, that certainly is a very good way of interpreting part of the ancient record, and I've heard others interpret it in that way. I don't have any problem with thinking of it in that way.
Sort of like hijacking the human tabernacle or siphoning off some of the breath of life portion of humanity genetically into their code so that they can raise their race.
Well, and certainly this could even go back to the origins of the folklore about vampirism. But look at the implication behind that activity in Genesis 6. I like to read the interlinear Hebrew Bible. But
yeah, exactly. Genesis 6 is absolutely fascinating.
And where it says that the B'nai Elohim saw the daughters of Adam as what? They were fit extensions.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole idea, fit extensions, is something that takes us back to pathways, to portals. Something where you find the use of molecular energy being formatted to somehow provide a navigational dimensional pathway.
Oh, so it's more than just a physical body through which to interpret this universe. It's actually an extension.
It's the manipulation of energy at the atomic and subatomic and molecular level.
Ah.
It's a mystery that, now, you as a scientist could understand the scientific side of it more than I as an exorcist could.
Well, I was just going to ask, do you think the mysterious 223 genes in our human code came from somewhere off planet?
Well, I, of course, in my research, I've ran into the fact on more than one occasion that there are certain parts of the genetic code that certainly cannot be explained in terms of earth elements. So there, but look, what, Brooke, what if by corrupting this species barrier, and you read in Genesis, God puts this barrier up, each species recreates after its own kind.
Mm-hmm.
But what if by breaching that barrier that was commanded by the Creator, these super intelligences had somehow successfully mingled human, animal, plant DNA? And by combining the hereditary traits of these several kinds of species into a new being, they had created what we think of as Nephilim, the fallen ones, mutations. And these were beings now who might suddenly possess the combined intelligence, the instincts, the seeing, the hearing, the smelling, the reacting to the environment of several different kinds of life forms in ways that would have been unfamiliar to ancient men, and maybe even explains why ancient men were terrified of them and saw them as being children of the gods. Now today, as you know probably better than I do, molecular biologists, they classify the functions of genes inside of their native species. But all of them, at least up until now, are unsure, in many cases, how a gene's coding might react if it's taken from one species and transgenically made part of another species.
Well, that wonder is slowly disappearing as we take genes from jellyfish or white mice or, well, there are some that are more closely related to us, chimpanzees and pigs, and treat humans with that and experiment with that. So the wonder is beginning to go away. And, of course, this whole world of ethics is opening up. And naturally, conspiracy theorists are those who are already suspicious of government's handling of the data that comes from these experiments. All of this becomes suspicious. You mentioned that 25% of the money spent on healthcare is being spent in research and manipulation, or at least experimentation with the human genome. That's a fact. I mean, my brother is a director of physiology at Johns Hopkins, and he has a whole floor of his building dedicated to just that. But I don't know the specifics of that, but I can tell you whatever's going on there is definitely cutting edge. And I know that he, on a regular basis, he goes to Washington and obtains funding to do that.
Right.
And that's all I know about it. But my question is, why would beings so advanced, I know why we meddle with it, but why would beings so advanced and apparently immune to the pains of mortality design for themselves such frail and awkward bodies?
Well, of course, now, if you could go to a very conservative Christian point of view that has to do with war, that has to do with ancient war, in which the creator comes into conflict with the watchers, Lucifer, angels that rise up in rebellion, and part of the rebellion is to contaminate or destroy that which was created by the creator.
Sure, that's evident.
That's one way of looking at it. But you could talk to your brother, and you could find that they're already saying that there's unpredictable changes, unpredictable things are already happening. I mean, we're seeing this in genetically modified crops. So,
really, like what? I know I've seen wheat and barley and corn and things that are resistant to disease, resistant to drought. But as far as I know, animals and people that have been fed with such crops haven't seen any. Maybe they have.
They have.
Oh,
I mean, there's. And some of this has been significantly covered up, but you on your own time could go to Seeds of Deception and look at some of the good research that's been done by the author of that book. But like R. Pat Buste, who's a respected biologist over Rowett Research Institute in Aberdeen, Scotland, he was doing a whole series of experiments with a scientist named Stanley Ewan on potatoes that had been inserted with a gene from the snowdrop plant. And rats that were being fed with those potatoes had all kinds of organ damage that was being developed, depressed immune systems. And Buste even found that genetic modification was destabilizing the genome of the potato, a finding that essentially indicated that genetic modification, unlike other kinds of breeding methods, would do things that are uncontrollable, that are unpredictable, things that through cross-contamination or even wind-borne crossbreeding might start affecting other plants. And by the way, he was fired from his job and forced out of his position at Rowett. He was eventually restored, and his findings there, and I don't want to go into the side of why he was fired, because it goes to some of the biggest research laboratories that have a hell of a lot to lose from any kind of negative publicity about genetically modified crops. But he eventually got his job back, and his research stuff was independently studied, was peer-reviewed, and found to be right. Not long after he did his review, there was a Russian National Association for Genetic Security that was studying this, and they hired a Dr. Irina Ermakova, and she was doing the same thing, and she described how that after only 3 weeks, half of groups that were being rats that were being fed with genetically modified soy were dying prematurely. And get this, Ermakova was using Monsanto's Roundup Ready soy which has genes that are inserted in it that help it withstand Monsanto's Roundup brand of herbicides, which I think you might have been referring to. And about 85% of the soy now that's being grown in the United States is Roundup ready. And half of the research rats that were eating products made from that soy were dying prematurely. It was affecting a great deal of their, and by the way, everything I'm saying to you could be substantiated. So, my point about all of this is not that there should be a ban on genetically modified crops. My point about all of this is let's not rush into a new science that we know very little about, and especially let's not rush into a new science that begins changing the human species in the same kind of ways that we're doing right now with test animals and genetically modified crops when we don't really know what that means. I mean, you might have saw the news over the past couple of weeks where on several fronts there is now this push to clone humans. But they're not just talking about embryo cloning. They're talking about transgenically altering these embryos.
Well, that's quite a jump.
And huh?
That's a real jump there to go, to say, well, I lost little Scotty, and here's some DNA from his, stillborn body. Can you make another one? Going from that to saying, let's make a 6'9". 400-pound man that can run 40 miles an hour and take one in the chest and keep walking. That's a completely different thrust.
It is, but everything is done acrimonically.
Sure.
And the thing is, Brooke, all of this is moving forward. Everything is moving forward. We just came out of the Human Enhancement Tech and Human Rights Conference at Stanford University. We just came out of Oxford University's Human Enhancement Conference, and all you have to do is go and read the subject matter that they were talking about, the classes that they held, where they're talking about how much morphological diversity can the polity sustain, animal-human, chimeric enhancement, and animal rights and human rights. One of the classes there was germline engineering and the consent of future generations. One of the classes was procreative liberty and the genetic enhancement of children. I mean, we simply are moving forward into transhumanism. It is going to happen. It's a simple fact. So for me, I'm not this prophet that's standing out here on a stump somewhere screaming about the advances of science. What I'm saying is, man, everybody catch their breath, because what we're tinkering with now, we know very little about.
Yeah. And there's a point at which you say, wouldn't it be neat if we could do this? That might be a bad thing. We're not ready.
Yeah, it certainly could be. Now, I mean, in our own very crude ways, we've been doing this all along. We wear glasses. We've been doing things to enhance ourselves for a long time anyway, to try to elevate the human condition. I don't have any problem with that. The whole idea behind medicine is to provide for ourselves a better, physical life while we're here. And
sure,
certainly, I tell people I want to live forever too, but I don't want to live forever if I got to become a Nephilim, for crying out loud.
Well, but that being said, we see genetic weaknesses being propagated in our population because they're surviving. People with diabetes are living.
Right.
People with asthma are living. People with arthritis
right.
are living. Leukemia and such. We're curing it, but after the fact, after the genetic fact.
Right.
And as that group is multiplying by getting married and having children, we are seeing a rise in things like asthma and arthritis and diabetes, just because, by nature of that genetic information surviving.
Right.
It's going to the next generation. So.
And so now, what does it mean?
Well, it doesn't mean that the human race is becoming weaker, as some people might put the case forward, but it does mean that the impetus of requiring a cure, not a treatment, but a cure, tends to precipitate out of markets, just like genetic research, this kind of research.
There again, I am pro person. If you go to Raiders News Update, you find out it's all about individual rights. That's everything that motivates us. We don't like intrusions by government or anybody else, not religion either, in terms of its attempt to become an American Taliban or a national, a global Taliban or anything else where it beats down the individual or seeks to manipulate persons or anything else. I want to see people live better lives, healthier lives. I only have concerns that what sometimes can look like a promise could be Pandora's box. And boy, it's a whole lot better to be smart on the front side than it is to try to mop it up after the fact.
Oh, no question about it.
When it's got out of the box. And so now, you know, when I'm over Raiders News Update, when I'm reading the news this week, and you know, you got the team that brought us Dolly the Sheep now that's moving ahead with transgenic human cloning. You got Harvard University that received funding this last week, or the promise of funding, and they're moving ahead with not just cloning, transgenic human cloning. You got BioEdge, that's an online biotechnology magazine that ran an article called Upgrading to Human 2.0, in which they were talking about the powers of the mutants in the recent films X-Men, the X-Men movies, talking about how it's not fanciful, it's not ridiculous, it's actually the future, and that a growing number of academics believe that that's where we're going, to humans 2.0. I mean, this whole idea of Stanford, I mean, we're not talking about a little dinky little private law schools. We're talking about the wealthiest law schools in the country when we're talking about Harvard, we're talking about Oxford, we're talking about Stanford University, and they're bringing together these greatest legal minds and academics in the world to talk about, you know, what will be the constitutional rights, the liberties, the freedoms, the protections for persons who are no longer human in the sense that we are human today. And I'm just sitting out here thinking, you know what, I can't believe that only 7 years ago I started doing the research for transgenics when nobody was talking about this, and only 7 years later we're talking about post-humanity. Maybe we should put the brakes on here, Brooke, and look at what we're talking about before we go through a gateway from which there's no recovery. Because now we're talking about changing the human race to something modern men have never seen before. Now, for instance, can I give you a for instance?
Sure, let's have a couple of examples.
Animals, now you know this, animals can do things that we can't do. They can sense earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
They smell tumors. Some of them, like dogs, can hear sounds at 40,000 hertz. Dolphins, much higher than that, I think something like 100,000. It's also known that some animals can see wavelengths of the electromagnetic spectrum beyond mm-hmm. our human ability. And I have this suspicion, to go back maybe to some of the stuff I've written and probably some of the stuff you've written, I suspect that as our understanding of quantum physics, including light and dark matter, things like that, expand, we may come to understand more fully and to appreciate more fully these biblical references to beings of light and beings of darkness. Because, you know, Brooke, only now are we coming to a point in human understanding that we understand that the natural world as we view it, this three-dimensional matrix in which we live our day-to-day lives, is a pretty small fragment of the supernatural reality of which we're really a part.
Well, I mean, you don't even really have to use the word supernatural. In freshman chemistry, we open a section on spectroscopy by talking about the wavelengths the human eye can see and the fact that this is just a small sliver of the information that's available in the universe. Now, we use sophisticated instruments to detect all of that, but you know, some of that's outside of the realm or the reach of our instruments as well. But the fact is that when people say seeing is believing, it's sort of like, you know, saying everything I can see through the keyhole
yeah.
is everything that's in this room.
Sorry.
And once you open that up to people, you show them, all right, here's a photograph in visible light. Now look at the same photograph in infrared
right.
or ultraviolet.
And I can tell you from my background, I mean, you know, exoteric knowledge, the longer you're honest with information, you start finding out it's really a small piece of esoteric, or whatever reality, whatever terms you want to use to define what reality really is. And the interesting thing is that these ancients we've been talking about, whether it's from the Bible or Sumeria or whatever, these ancient societies actually seem to have understood this. or at least they were impacted with the knowledge that brought them to understand it.
Well, at least they accepted it. I don't know how well they understood it, although we do see carvings of them learning about 11 planet solar systems or learning about portals through which planets can move across space. We don't know how much they understood, but at least they accepted it. Our society generally, at least the official view, is we don't accept it.
Don't you think that's kind of the dominance of Western our knowledge, or at least our approach to science, that we've dominated the world for the last 100 years, and we've led mankind into kind of a fact-based or whatever it is. But it's a method of science that in eternity we're going to laugh at, because there's far more that we don't see that exists all around us. It, they, beyond the veil, the beings, the science, light and darkness, angels and demons, extraterrestrial intelligence, whatever phrases you want to put on all of that, is a monstrous portion of our reality that we as yet now haven't fully accepted.
Oh yeah, we've been in denial. But I'll tell you, in the 4 decades that I've played with this kind of information, I've seen postulates and constants and theories, you know, fall by the wayside as the fable of yesterday's science makes itself known and the new truth becomes known. We've created a religion of scientists, and there are high priests, and there are, you know, courts that will judge you and cast you out or blackball you, and you know that's the way it is. And it's a shame that the terminology that's used, you know, you use terms like beings of light or beings of darkness or other dimensions. You know, even 5 years ago, this kind of talk was highly frowned upon in the professional community. Now, I don't know if it's because, you know, the sci-fi babies are starting to get their PhDs now, or if it's the very imagination that drives the sci-fi world has always been the imagination that drives the real science world.
Right. It's funny too, because when you're as old as I am, you know, you look back when you was a kid and watching Buck Rogers in the 21st century and Dick Tracy and all that with his monstrosity of a wristwatch, you know, that he could talk into. But you realize that the kind of things that we envision as science fiction today, it's more than reality tomorrow. And so that I don't leave your listeners out there with an unanswered question, I wanted to make a point about this whole upgrading to humans 2.0, and I had started talking about how that, you know, that everything that we don't see is probably a bigger piece of reality than the keyhole image that we are seeing, to use your phrase. And usually we never see the reality there, or the intelligences that are there, except under rare or special occasions. Not only in the sense that they've appeared in the past, but even the Bible itself talks about those rare occasions where we have engaged angels unaware or whatever. But there is a distinction between humans, either by design or by fall, and you can interpret it any way you want, that we're something different now than we were created to be, or we simply were created not to have the same kind of ability that animals have in terms of what they can see, what they can hear, what they can do, and so on. Now, so when you're thinking in terms of blending of humans with animals, creating chimeras, you think about these animals, some of them that can see different things. But ask yourself the question, can some of them see beings, spirits?
Oh, I would say that I know lots of people that say their dogs or cats or birds can sense beings in the room, even when they cannot.
Well, maybe not even, maybe more than sense. Can they see them?
Sure.
See, because they can see things in the spectrums we can't see. And by the way, the Bible provides verification of that in the story of Balaam's donkey. When it tells the story of, you know, here's dumb Balaam riding down the road, and his donkey sees this angel standing in the road with his sword drawn, going to take off dumb Balaam's head, and Balaam keeps kicking the donkey, trying to get it back on the road. It's a very simplistic story, but what is written between the lines there is intriguing. in the sense that you have an animal that can see something that a human cannot see. Now, of course, researchers, you know, have been uncovering that kind of evidence for a long time now, that animals...
Well, I was just thinking of how ironic that story is, that eventually the donkey speaks to Balaam.
That's right.
So maybe it takes a donkey to talk to the scientific community and say, look, you keep prodding me to go in this direction. Don't you see what I see?
Well, the truth is, Brooke, I've had more than one jackass in my life that gave me information that I should have listened to. Look, but so that I at least answer the question that I posed, think about what that means when you have those kind of stories, but you can't easily relegate them to mythology. When you have researchers today that are telling us that animals can do things, maybe even see things that we don't see. You know, like you were mentioning, you people who sometimes see their dog barking or growling at, to them, what appears to be nothing. Running and hiding under the bed or something like that. I mean, reacting to something we can't see. Or entire populations of animals migrating days before there might be an earthquake or a tsunami. Now, imagine what all of that instinct, what all of that means. If you had, let me go out here beyond the X-File for a moment. If you had government laboratories with unlimited budgets working way beyond congressional review in SAPOC operations, where they are decoding the gene functions that lead to animal as well as human propensities, of sense and smell and sight, you could create literally the ultimate psychotronic warfare, and commit it against entire populations by agenteurs who could appear to be human, but who see and even interact with invisible forces. Now, I know that sounds incredible, and yet biblical and apocryphal texts indicate that might have been what was going on with the Nephilim, which brings this entirely new context to this whole fear factor that ancient men had of these beings. And yet, to go back to something you said a minute ago, that terrifying possibility is only the tip of the iceberg, because if interbreeding between regular and transgenic humans, and by the way, that's a possibility that not only do some people believe maybe explains Genesis 6 and the Great Flood, in the sense that there was this, well, for want of a better term, there was this genetic
cataclysm,
something that happened that was being spread through intermarriage,
right,
that eventually led to the Great Flood, the wiping out of the population, starting over again. But now we're talking about a repossibility, given modern man's science and man's tendency to sometimes throw caution to the wind when given the chance to play God, because if interbreeding between transhumans and regular humans ever occurs, and by the way, it's going to. You heard it here, ladies and gentlemen. Tom Horn, I'm telling you right now, it's going to. Once that mutated DNA gets out of the bottle, when that happens, animal characteristics, or if you can accept the whole idea, alien characteristics, are going to be introduced to the human species, and it's going to alter the human genetic code. Eventually, it's going to eliminate humanity as you know it today, unless there's that group of people who can do something to make sure that it doesn't go there, at least that it doesn't go there until they want it to go there.
Well, the way it was done in historical times is there were tribes that refused to have relations outside their tribe, so they
right.
preserved their genetic code while all the other genetics, you know, fell apart and was corrupted. But, you know, we're not talking about potatoes killing first generation mice. Now, I was thinking maybe over a period of generations, mice or rats would experience some kind of genetic weakness and have a propensity to weak bones or blindness or kidney failure or something like that. But what you described to me was first generation death from rats eating soybeans.
That's good science, by the way. It's been peer reviewed. It's now been published in scientific journals. So, and what I would say, Brooke, it's why some people believe that current advances by modern scientists to blend DNA of various species using transgenics, whether it's genetically modified crops or mice with human brains or goats with human blood or rabbit human embryos, or now human clones being transgenically altered. All of this raises, for want of a better term, a prophetic possibility.
Sure. That you'll eventually create an immortal.
Well, that's the objective. That's the goal.
But you see the political pressure. I mean, it doesn't take a Christopher Reeves with a spinal cord injury pushing T-cell research or stem cell research. It goes much further than that. You have muscular sclerosis. You have cystic fibrosis. You've got kidney failure, diabetes, all these kinds of things. Sure, people want to see those cured, but does that mean that we create an embryo that's immune to all of these things, implant it, let it be born, and then let it proliferate or propagate with the rest of the race?
Well, what I would say is people can right now can look at where we already know transgenics already is.
Sure.
Forget what futurists say it might be. Look at what transgenics is already doing. Number one, in animal-human chimera research. Already, Chinese scientists at Shanghai Second Medical University have successfully fused human cells with rabbit eggs. Now, they're doing that because, Dr. Huang falsified some of his information in human cloning and acquired eggs from some of his employees, which is against part of their policy, and that created problems. He's probably going to go to prison now, for some of the stuff he did. But they were able to verify that his dog Snoopy, which was the recipient of Time Magazine's Invention of the Year, that it actually was a clone. So some of the research was real. It sounds like he just got ahead of himself, and it, like sometimes these guys do, wanted to push the funding and the science and everything quicker than what it was coming to him, and so he did some things he shouldn't have done. So now various other research laboratories, which are trying to follow the letter of the law and do this thing the right way, they're saying, where are we going to get enough eggs? I mean, it requires a significant amount of eggs to do this kind of experimenting. And since we're kind of on the cutting edge of this science, there aren't that many places where the local lady can go and sell some of her, resource eggs.
No, but we have a $1 billion industry in the United States where fetal material is open to be harvested. And I don't know if the listeners know this or not, but a female human is born with all the eggs she's going to possess in her lifetime. She doesn't make new eggs.
Right.
So once you collect a fetus, especially a third trimester fetus, you've got all the raw materials you need.
Right. Now, are we comfortable with that?
No, absolutely. I think the current administration has been very vocal about that, and Senator Frist has been very vocal about that. But that doesn't mean that not so ethical but intelligent and accomplished medical organizations won't continue with that research. You just mentioned transgression.
And this week, Harvard University and the lab that worked on Dolly the sheep have already announced that they intend to do it, and they already have the funding, and they don't care what the administration says. Now, of course, that could be, that could result in some form of new legislation or whatever. But why I mentioned the Shanghai Second Medical University is because they've said, okay, let's say this gets embroiled in politics. We can't get the number of eggs we need. Rabbits are very fertile. We'll create rabbit-human embryos. Mm-hmm. And out of those embryos, we'll acquire the eggs that we need to do stem cell harvesting or whatever for the type of research we want to do that. But that's already happening. So my whole point about transgenics is we're not talking about a futuristic science. Last year in Minnesota, at the Mayo Clinic, they created pigs with human blood flowing through their bodies. Stanford University, last year, by the way, created these mice that had 10% human brains. Irv Wiseman, he's the director over there at Stanford University's Institute of Cancer and Stem Cell Biology and Medicine, he did that research. But this year, they intend to conduct a second experiment, and this time, believe it or not, the mice are going to have 100% human brains, and they're actually already drawing up guidelines. By the way, that's going to be done by them putting human neurons in the brains of these embryonic mice.
Now, does that mean that the mice will be not human intelligent? They won't have a human-sized brain or concentration, but it could mean that they produce chemicals or enzymes that are needed to treat diseases like Alzheimer's.
Well, that's part of the idea, but get the guidelines. The guidelines say that if the researchers recognize that any of these humanized animals start developing human cognitive activity, and in particular, if they become self-aware, then they have to be destroyed.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, can you even imagine that we live in a day where that question, where that guideline, but it illustrates what I'm talking about in terms of not only where the science could go, where it's at now, where it is going, where it's already operating. I mean, I don't think 10 years ago I could have even believed that that question would be poised, but now it's just, there it is. It's just part of what our research laboratory is using in terms of their guidelines. And by the way, the irony of this is that it's the animal rights people who are complaining more about this kind of research than anybody else. There's an activist, a biotechnology activist named Jeremy Rifkin. I don't know if you've ever heard of him.
No.
But he's opposed to crossing these species barriers because he believes that animals have the right to exist without being tampered with or crossed with other species to the extent that they start becoming self-aware, because then it would be inhumane to put them to death. They would be protected under our Constitution. And so you can see what a monstrous can of worms this whole thing is. In fact, one of the examples that he gives, he says, if genetically engineered mice begin producing human sperm and eggs intentionally, that's why we make them, and then by doing in vitro fertilization, we produce a child, the child is actually the offspring of a pair of mice. So, and by the way, over in Israel right now, some of their leading scholars over there and scientists are probably the ones who are more on the forefront of talking about these transgenic beings that we're making, and they're talking about, you know, if you created a sheep that is humanized, is it then okay to offer it as a sacrifice? I mean, it's just mind-boggling the level of complicity that we're creating now, complications that we're creating now as a result of the science. But so what's happening in transgenics? First of all, you have this whole thing with animal-human chimeras. It's already happening. Secondly, there's this whole novelty science that's in the news now because of these events that just were finished at some of our leading universities in terms of what laws need to be created to protect transhumans, posthumans. And so now you have this emerging human enhancement piece of this transgenic puzzle. The National Institute of Health just approved funding a project at Case Law School as a point of reference to develop guidelines for how re-engineering the human species should take place, and what are the implications, both ethically, legally, and so on. And now you got Dr. Joe Rosen, who works over at the Dartmouth Medical Center, New Hampshire. And he's done science work for NASA and all these different people, but he wrote an article not long ago called "I'm Having My Wings Done," in which and he was talking in all seriousness, Brooke, you laugh, but he's dead serious.
No, but I can see that's a great title.
Well, I don't know if you saw the new X-Men movie. But for those who have seen the new X-Men movie, and you have that guy in there with the wings that can fly, Dr. Rosen says not fiction. And matter of fact, he says that within 5 years, we're going to have humans with wings. Within 5 years. And this is one of the leading researchers at the acclaimed Dartmouth Center. And he's actually envisioning these techniques that are going to be used, everything from grafting to this, you know, this new science that we're talking about now where we can regrow lost limbs like reptoids. He envisions using that kind of science through transgenics to manipulate future humans into the, literally into the image of angels and demons. He's even gone so far as to make blueprints of what these transhumans are going to look like, and at a recent science conference, he said that the only thing now holding us back from advancing faster in this kind of research is our restrictive Judeo-Christian conservatism, and that once we get past that, the sky's the limit in terms of transhumanism. So that's another part of transgenics. The third part of what's going on in transgenics is the military applications.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in our third hour, but I do want to let people know you don't have to think about this in future tense. You only need to go to Roslyn Chapel in Roslyn, Scotland, and look at the carvings on the walls, and there are many of the pictures that I took in that chapel last July are in Volume 2 of the Ark of Millions of Years, and you can see these genetic anomalies with wings, with elongated limbs, with fur, with human faces and human hands and human feet. They're in carving, and they've been there since 1442, just to give you an idea how that stuff can exist out there. Well, before we begin our third hour, I just wanted to remind you that my guest is Tom Horn. We're having an absolutely fascinating discussion, and his book is called Ehrman's Gate, and we'll take about 5 minutes of commercials, and we will be right back with X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew. Bear with me just one moment. Well, I was just trying to get my music to play, but it appears that my CD player doesn't like my CD that I've put in. Oh, here we go. And we'll be right back after these messages. One of the things we have learned here at X Squared Radio from our emails is that many listeners to this program are educators. Well, we have recently added a great affiliate for you. The Academic Superstore is the place where you can buy software, neat tools and gadgets, and even supplies such as calculators and iPod peripherals at huge discounts. The best things for the classroom and for the student are just a tax-free click away. All you have to do is click the Academic Superstore sign at X Squared Radio and start saving. The space shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store and ordered a 25-inch model of the Space Orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. If you know someone who loves the space program and you want to get them a gift that they will never forget, you should visit the space store at X Squared Radio. You probably know Kevin Smith as one of the premier talk radio hosts in the world today. Well, now there is a new reason to know the name. His new book, Gods in the Garden. It's a shining light of truth in print that takes us back to the origins of mankind. Don't be afraid to find out who you really are and where you came from. The answer will open the windows of knowledge for you so you can see everything for yourself. Visit his website at kevinsmithshow.com or purchase it at the online store at X Squared Radio today. People are always looking for something inexpensive and unique to give people they love. Well, now there is a way to give a gift that not only says how long you will love them, but it also allows you to help keep the planet green and growing. Tree Givers at X Squared Radio is the company that will plant a tree on public lands somewhere in the 50 states and provide your special person with a beautiful certificate of that placement. This has become one of the most popular gift sites in the world. And because of their love for the Earth, they are changing the world. So visit Tree Givers at X Squared Radio and see if you can find a gift for your special person. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. Back to X Squared Radio. I'm Brooks Agnew, your host. This is where the past meets the future. My guest tonight is Tom Horn. His amazing book, Airman's Gate, can be purchased, I guess, everywhere online, right? Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and your website.
They can get it. You know, they have some specials that Donna put together over there at RaidersNewsUpdate.com, but they can get it at Amazon.com. They can go into their local store and get it.
Great. All right, well, listen, we've covered the fact that UFOs exist. We've talked about stargates. We've talked about transgenic humans. And we sort of opened the door and talked about transgenic science, right?
Right.
So now we're going to talk about governments and how they might be looking at this transgenic science. I mean, it's not just the medical curiosity that's out there, is it?
Well, it's not. I mean, you went to the break talking about some photographs that you had taken in Europe of these very old depictions of these transgenic beings with wings and things like that. You know, there are Assyrian depictions that date all the way back to King Salamasser, the second, that are in, you know, British museums there in London, things like that, but that show these human-animal hybrids, and they don't show them in the sense that it's just a magical interpretation of a god, but I mean they show them kind of in a real-world, everyday situation on the end of a leash, being led by somebody somewhere, and it's like a lion with a human's head that's sucking its thumb. I mean, I think that there was something that was lost. But something that, and by the way, that even the, I think personally, and we can talk about this a little bit, but I think personally that even the prophets of the Bible said, going to happen again at the end of time when the earth goes through earth changes, and there will be people who will be elevated, and there will be some that won't. So when you look at all of that, and if you put stock in all of that, then of course you can't help but when you're looking at what's happening with transgenics to be cautious, not only in the sense, and by the way, Brooke, if I had no religious worldview at all, I'd be very concerned with the whole idea of tinkering with the human genetic code I'd want to make sure, because this is something that changes what we are, not just treats us medicinally.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, because I have to think, I was in the Air Force, but only for one tour, but I learned enough about the way that the military works and the way leadership thinks, especially when they're trying to think about hypothetical situations. And one of the things that I could envision is a group of, well, they could be military or non-military, but men and women sitting around going, okay, well, if we decide as a country not to do this kind of research, not to tinker with the human genome or to transgenically produce a human, what stops our enemies from doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens if, you know, much like we were taken by surprise with the blitzkrieg of World War II, rather than you know, having Stukas and Panzers charging across the desert at us, we have, you know, 100,000 transgenic humans that can run 40 miles an hour.
Well, and unless anybody thinks that what we're talking about now is pure speculation, I want to help them understand that we're there. And by the way, anybody listening to what I'm talking about could even just go to Google or Yahoo tonight and do word searches on the subject matter we're talking about. They'll find for themselves that there's leading research that will link back to government websites, DARPA, NASA. You read no doubt about the transgenic spider goats that already are being manufactured to produce spider silk because to produce this in their milk because spider silk's really strong, so it has a military application. And this whole idea of producing these spider goats is being funded by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and by other departments of the military, because they discovered that it's difficult to start a spider farm and to milk spiders. And so
I would say so, especially the really big ones that could make a lot of webs might be pretty scary to work with.
Right, but it's incredibly strong, and so they create these transgenic beings that never existed before until now, unless maybe they existed, you know, thousands of years ago, but they haven't existed in our time. And they're doing that because they can now harvest this silk from these spider goats, and they can use it for making products, you know, like cargo nets and maybe bulletproof vests or whatever it is they're using it for, because it's very strong. But other well-funded projects that are being paid for by tax dollars through DARPA, and which they're working on with relation to transgenics. Some of this stuff, Brooke, is reminiscent. I mean, it's almost like Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, where you have the wizard Saruman fashioning his monstrous Uruk-hai to wage this relentless, remorseless war for dominion. Because now what we're looking at is this very real scheme that's being pursued by the Pentagon, whose wizards are working on the creation of what's called extended performance warfighters. And a person could go to Google tonight and type that in, extended performance warfighters. And go to the government's own website. You'll be astonished, because the warfighter enhancement program actually involves four basic components. Number one, injecting human men and women with these hormonal and neurological and genetic concoctions. Secondly, implanting them with microchips and electrodes in their bodies in order to try to control their internal organs and brain functions. Thirdly, applying them with drugs that might deaden some of their normal human tendencies, like the need for sleep and the fear of death, but also the reluctance to kill their fellow human beings. But fourthly, and this is the part that, of course, engages me, it actually involves altering the genetic code of soldiers by modifying bits of their DNA to fashion literally a new type of human specimen that could function like a machine, a killing machine, that could just be on the battlefield for days and nights on end and fight until it can't stand up anymore. And there again, I mean, I would encourage people because that's so astonishing. It sounds so sci-fi. I would encourage people to go and search at Yahoo, search at Google, to verify for themselves from government websites that what I have just said is a matter of fact. But then that, Brooke, brings us to the fourth thing that's happening in transgenics. It's already happening in transgenics, and it's ratcheting up very quickly, and that is this push for transhumanism. And for me, transhumanism is the biggie, and it's the place where I think we need to stop. We need to really think through what we're doing now, because
we've kind of been conditioned as a modern society. We have seen a whole sport almost come to its knees because the fans have demanded that more home runs get smacked over the wall every single year. We have, you know, steroids, which have been a mainstay of professional sports for, I don't know, probably 25 years. Now, you know, get exposed, and you know what? I see government getting all upset. I see the press getting all upset, but I don't really see the fans getting all upset. You know, we like it when padded players run at 30 miles an hour at each other, and we love to watch the replays in slow motion. You know, we're a gladiator society, but we're being conditioned to this kind of performance, and it's almost being glorified. I see the military commercials. You have supplies for 3 days. It's now day five.
Right.
You know, and you're sitting up on the hill with your scope in full camouflage. It is being glorified, and I see why this can be, you know, so frightening when people catch the vision of what you're describing.
And I agree with you, and I think, you know, in many different parts of our popular media, we've been preconditioned to accept this, but it's a very superficial approach to understanding what it might mean to enter into a transhuman period of time. And once again, I would want your listeners to know that I'm not an anti-science guy, I'm for things that can create a better life experience for people. But we're talking now about a science, about something we know nothing about. There's no precedent for us in modern history to tell us what lessons might be learned by tinkering with the human genetic code, and especially not only tinkering with it, but blending it with other species. There's no way to know what Pandora's box would be open. And just forget for a moment the whole idea of biblical prophecy or any of those things. Just think in terms of the kinds of diseases that are unknown to us that could be introduced into the human, that could, and I don't want to sound apocalyptic here, it could literally wipe out a great deal of the human species. It could be a nightmare. And these things need to be very carefully in very controlled environments tested, if tested at all, before we rush out to begin changing the human species. But the point is, what you said, we've been preconditioned for it. We're excited about it. It's where we're going.
Not only that, you know, we, at least as this country, if it's going to save a lot of lives or shortcut victory, we have no compunction about dropping a weapon that,
right,
you know, literally could have lit the entire atmosphere on fire, to shorten a war. So if we're going to drop a genetic anomaly into a society or a group of them, in hopes of weakening it, destabilizing it, corrupting it, maybe even, you know, in a virile way, messing up its genetic ability to survive as a country. I see a history for that. We do that.
I know.
So,
and
I want to ask you a question, because I'm going to try and push this to the next level here. So how does this transhumanism and the Stargate technology tie into the invasion of Iraq and the possible invasion of Iran? What is the connection?
Let me try to answer a two-part question. First of all, just taking where we were and moving forward into this whole idea of why we went into Iraq. First of all, the whole idea of genetic modification and transgenics and the military applications of transhumanism, this whole idea that we're going to mix these biotechno-cogno sciences and lead to the next stage in human evolution, that by combining these sciences, you know, we're poised to redefine what it means to be a human and to move beyond the current confines of life as we know it. And the cause celebs are out there. I mean, the futurists, Ray Kurzweil, guys like that, great thinkers, great people. They're out there. They're pushing for this moment of singularity in which we're going to become godlike. People need to understand how quickly. It's becoming mainstream. It's already here. It's already happening. And, you know, you... Here's. I won't take time to talk about this because I know we want to move on now. But some of your listeners could go out there and just search for the article "Alchemy and Transmutation: Changing and Creating Things and People" by Arnold Brown, who's the chairman of the leading strategic scanning consultancy, Weiner, Edrick and Brown. He's part of this whole movement. He's a very intelligent guy. He's the he's the director of the World Future Society. He's written books for Future Think. The bottom line is, his point is that in that book, many scientists now are not just aware of what we could do. They are eager. They are eagerly exploring how we are going to be transmutated into a superior form of humanity through the convergence of this info-bio-cogno technology, and that as a result of all of this, the understanding of the mind now, and what we are as humans and of our limitations, that now we are poised to take humanity to the next phase in evolution. And they speak of it in terms of us becoming a god. And by the way, Leon Cass, who is a hyper conservative in my opinion, he was the former chairman of the President's Council on Bioethics. And after he had served his commission on that committee and looked at all of the available information, the best science that we have available to us now, he made a public statement in which he summed all of it up after he came off that committee. He said all of the natural boundaries now are up for grab. All of the boundaries that have defined us as human beings. Boundaries between a human being and an animal on the one side, and between a human being and a superhuman being or a god on the other. The boundaries of life, the boundaries of death, these are the questions of the 21st century, and nothing could be more important, end quote. So you're talking about the chairman for the President's own Council on Bioethics saying that right now, we are now walking through the doorway, Brooke, of the difference between what it means to be humans as we've known them and to become a god. So according to the former chairman of the President's own Council on Bioethics, nothing is more important than what you and I are talking about right now. Now, why is that the case? And now this is the second step, and then I'm going to go to why we went into Iraq. Can I do that?
Yeah, I was just going to provide one quick answer, that the reason is that if we don't and they do, then we're at a distinct disadvantage. And so it is our national policy that when there's something that is a national security threat or a clear and present danger, we will guard ourselves against it. It is our constitutional duty. And that's what's driving the military's interest in this.
Right. But I think there's a super intelligence operating behind the veil, you think?
I was just going to ask the next question. What we sort of drifted away from the off-worlders that were so involved in our ancient predecessors. Are they still involved now, and are they very excited that it's not they that have to manipulate all the genetics, but we who are capable of doing it, and with their guidance?
Yes.
Could be very powerful indeed.
Well, their guidance is the key word. Maybe it isn't just we or they. Maybe it's we and they.
Yes.
Something that always intrigued me, and I think maybe now only is starting to make real sense, and there again, now I'm going back to my to my history as a pseudo scholar, as a researcher, as an exorcist, as a pastor, as a theologian, Was this something that always intrigued me in light of this research? Was this a twofold part of the Genesis 6 story? Number one, and of course, there's a great deal there to be studied, but right now we're only talking about these two parts. Number one, that mature women were used, changed, altered in Genesis 6 to become these fit extension, these acceptable hosts for the watchers. Now, now think about that, because
they
we're not just
talking. They weren't infants. They were fully grown women.
They were fully grown. So now we're talking about genetic engineering of fully grown specimens. Secondly, what was going on there could be further illuminated in Genesis 10 concerning Nimrod, when it says he began to be a mighty. And now the idea there, he began, halal. There's a word study there that your listeners could do. It's very enlightening because the verb indicates there the beginning of profaning oneself or defiling oneself, and the sense about it is it is both ritual and sexual. Now, and that of course you know has caused some scholars to believe that the Watchers, what they did to humans in the lead up to the Nephilim was a sin against God. He began. He was defiled. But I'm reading a little bit more into that, because the whole idea that he began intrigues me. Because it suggests to me he wasn't, maybe he wasn't born this way. He was living his life. Then suddenly it says he began to be a mighty. And the word there, mighty, is Geborah, of which we derive Geborim, who some scholars make equivalent to the Nephilim. Others say these were the offspring of the Nephilim. But in any case, he began to be. I mean, you could take that phrase, and it would be good exegesis to interpret that phrase as saying Nimrod began to become a Nephilim, or Nimrod began to become a child of these Watchers. So the question then is, in Genesis 10, is this a record, in addition to what was happening with the women who were intermingled with these Watchers, is this a record of a mature human? I don't know whether he agreed. I don't know if this was something against his will, i.e. stuff that was happening with my sister and her daughter and her daughter. I don't know exactly what's being implied here, and that nobody ever really will know unless we come into further additional documentation that we uncover in some of our archaeological digs or something, because the record there is what it is. It's all we have. But the meanings of the words don't change. He began to become something that he wasn't, and what he began to become was a Geborah. Now, that's startling. Because it tells us that we have an adult, mature human who somehow began to be altered in some way. And I'm reading into that, of course, from my research, he began to be altered at the genetic level.
Well, you don't have to make a huge jump like that. Just go back to Genesis 2, where we talk about a rib of a man being removed.
Right.
And, of course, an altogether divine process, in my view. Eve is manufactured out of that genetic material.
No, and you're exactly right, and that's why I'm saying that it, obviously I'm not covering, but there's a huge, humongous amount of information here. But I'm picking this one out particularly for this second point, and that is that the offspring of that genetic alteration seem to have, in this particular case, seem to have led to the reincarnation of dead Nephilim.
There we go.
Now, note the rendering here. Genesis 6:4. Afterward, when the B'nai Elohim came into the daughters of Adam and they bore to them. Afterward. Now, I probably most scholars would feel comfortable with the idea that we're talking about pre-flood, post-flood activity here.
Sure, but the Nephilim were present before and after the flood.
That's the point that I'm making, that they were there before,
yeah,
then the flood came,
was that
but
they
now
left the
afterward.
Planet. Yeah, the
now
assumption
afterward.
Was that they left the planet and came back, but that may not, you're saying, necessarily be true. They were just re-embodied.
Well, but listen, well, I'm not, and at this point, I'm not even so much talking about who the designers are. I'm saying Look at this phrase. Afterward, when the B'nai Elohim came into the daughters of Adam and they bore to them. Now listen to what this phrase says. Again, I'm reading from the Interlinear Hebrew Bible. They were, now we're talking now about the offspring. The B'nai Elohim came into the daughters of them and they bore to them. And they were powerful ones which existed from ancient times. Now that's incredible, Brooke.
Because
the meaning there is that what was born to them existed before. What was reincarnated had already existed at one time before. The powerful ones were born to them, and it says this, Genesis 6:4, Interlinear Hebrew Bible, who existed from ancient times, the men of name. Now, in all of that, and here's what corroborates this, is that you not only have the Hebrews writing about this, the Hebrew scholars, both historians and religious scholars writing about this, but now you go outside of the Hebrew text and you find a harmony of texts from other cultures, and you find this historical relationship between the Nephilim and the Rapha, or the Rephaim, which are also talked about in the Bible.
Correct.
And these are viewed as the spirits of the dead Nephilim who died in the flood. And it's interesting because this, they came back again according to Genesis 6:4, but the term Rephaim carries with it the meaning to heal or to be healed, as in a resurrection,
or to be made whole,
or to be made whole. And what's and so now go outside of the Hebrew text and you take what's called the Rosh Shamra text, and in the Rosh Shamra the Rephaim are there again, and they're described as being both human and divine beings who worshipped the Amorite god Baal, the ruler of the underworld, where those Rephaim served as his acolyte assembly. They were lesser gods and kings and heroes and rulers, but the thing about them from Amorite texts is that these were beings who were believed to have the power to return from the dead through incarnation in bodily form as what we would call Nephilim. Now, the book of Job and many other scriptures, in fact, I'll give you a few, agree with that idea. The book of Job offers this intriguing bit of insight on the Rephaim, where it says, dead things are formed under the waters, Job 26:5. The dead in that text is the word Rapha, and the phrase are formed is from hull, meaning to twist or to whirl, as in a double helix coil, or as in genetic manufacturing.
Sounds like an excerpt from the Kabbalah as well.
Well, could be, but when you combine that fact with the Greek Septuagint, when it was created, we see that in the Septuagint, the Hebrew word Nephilim was translated into Greek as Giganus, and that's the word in Greek mythology for the Titans, creatures that were created through the interbreeding of the Greek gods and human beings. So now we have
Neptune and Hercules.
Well, but now you have the harmony of Hebrew, Amorite, Greek. By the way, and we won't do it tonight, but many other cultures who essentially use the same words and terms and stories, they're all telling this story. And but why is this interesting to me in terms of transgenics and where we all are today? Because the English word genes and genetics, these are all built around the same word Giganus, genia, meaning breed or kind, that was used in these texts to talk about, hey folks, there's these powerful, invisible, multidimensionals, and in their mythology, that dwell in the belly of the earth, and they can come back over and over. They can be reincarnated through some kind of science. What is this science? Well, it looks like, according to Enoch, transgenics. And it suggests this genetic component for the resurfacing of these giants, the resurrection of the Nephilim. Now, I said I would give you some of the Bible quotes for this, for those out there who are students of the Bible. The whole idea that the underworld is inhabited by the spirits of these dead giants and that they can rise from the dead is biblical. Did you know that? By the Hebrew text. here's some of the examples. Ezekiel 32:27. They segregated from the heroes, the old-time giants who entered, listen to this, this is astonishing, they entered into hell in full battle dress. It didn't say they were buried in battle dress. Look at the original language there. They went into hell in full battle dress. Proverbs 9:18, and he did not know that giants are there and that her guests are in the depths of hell. Proverbs 21:16, a man that shall wander out of the way of doctrine shall abide in the company of giants. Isaiah 14:9, hell below was in an uproar to meet thee at thy coming. It stirred up the giants for thee. Isaiah 26:14, let not the dead live. Let not the giants rise again. That's in one of my favorite versions, the Dewey version, the one that the Catholics might use a lot. But that's the scripture there, Brooke, now, that to me may actually even reflect a prayer from the prophet.
And we're not so removed from the giants. You know, a lot of people say, well, how come we didn't ever know these giants existed? Of course we did. Magellan ran into them. Columbus ran into them. We found their bones. We found their skulls. We found drawings and carvings and all kinds of statements where they helped with various construction projects, not the least of which is Stonehenge and the pyramids. You know, they existed. They existed.
And there might even be a massive Smithsonian cover-up in terms of what was first discovered here in the U.S. and dug up some of the large mounds here in the United States, which could have thrown question marks on our typical Judeo-Christian worldview, and so those were taken.
Is all of that? Why do we so readily accept evolution as doctrine, and we try to do away with Christianity in virtually every public aspect of life, but when it comes to revealing archaeological or architectural evidence that refutes the Christian view, it's buried?
Well, that has been our history. I have a feeling it's not going to last long. I think we're entering into a new period of time now where neither can it be covered up much longer, probably nor will it be. And when I say can it be, because I think that the prophets were telling us something. I think that these sages who were in tune with knowledge beyond what we understand today were telling us something. When Isaiah said in that scripture, let not the dead live, let not the giants rise again, I think that was actually a prayer from the prophet. I think that was a petition. Now, I might be wrong, but I think it was a petition to God not to allow the giants to incarnate again. I believe that Isaiah prayed that way because he knew something about the future, maybe something about transgenics, maybe something about animal-human blending, maybe something about something related to portals, maybe something about the giants who are prophesied to come through those pathways at the end of time. I mean, the prophet Isaiah, a lot of people don't know this. Did you know that he tied the return of the same beings of Genesis 6, the Nephilim, the Gaborim, the offspring of the powerful multidimensional watchers? I personally think he tied their return in with a prophecy about the exaltation and then the destruction of Babylon, of Iraq, in the last days. That's a term, last days, that I'm always a little bit hesitant to use that term, but it's a term that people identify with.
Sure.
In Isaiah 13, 1 through 3, 9, 19 through 22, in the Septuagint version, it actually says this: the vision which Isaiah, son of Amos, saw against Babylon. Lift up a standard on the mountain of the plain. Exalt the voices to them. Beckon with the hand. Now listen to these words from this prophet. Open the gates, ye ruler. I give command, and I bring them. Giants are coming to fulfill my wrath, rejoicing at the same time and insulting, end quote. Now, all Bible scholars accept that portion of Scripture as being a reference to a period of time in the future when Iraq and Iran, well, where Iraq, Babylon, would be invaded. Babylon would be restored. and Babylon would be destroyed in war. And Isaiah says, when that happens, gates are going to open, and Giborim are going to come through them. Giants are going to come. Now, I can only speculate if something more than is casually perceived by reading that was meant by Isaiah when he says, open the gates, ye ruler, because I don't know who the ruler is. I don't know if those are the gates of the city or if there's something more unusual as in stargates. But I wonder, when you asked me a moment ago, you know, what has all of this got to do with us going into Iraq, I wonder if we had an interest in Babylon. And I would tell people not to be too quick to bypass this whole question, because if you read that just in, you know, like the King James Version or something, it's going to say the gates are going to open, the mighty ones are going to come through it. But the word there, mighty, is Giborim. It's the same Hebrew term that's used redundantly in ancient texts.
Mm-hmm.
To refer either to the Nephilim or the offspring of the Nephilim. And the whole fantastic conclusion from this is, if you can accept it, is that Isaiah may have literally been saying that when Babylon is invaded and destroyed in the future, that it would mark a time when portals, gateways, are going to open, and the multidimensionals are going to return in full view.
I know Bible scholars, and I guess I used to think this way as well, that Isaiah was talking about types and shadows, and when he was talking about Babylon, he might have been talking about, you know, latter-day the United States, because we are sort of the Babylon of the modern world. But if you look at the originals, and I've got a Jerusalem Bible that gives a little bit different slant than that, but it's literally talking about Babylon, and now Babylon, the literal Babylon, has been invaded and is on the verge of being conquered. It's only a matter of time before that happens. And, you know, a lot of these carvings and the most ancient museums on the planet are in that area and have literally never been seen by Western civilization. I would love to go there. My wife says, oh, you're not going there, forget about it. But I would love to go there and start photographing things and putting these things in catalogs that no Western person has ever seen. I mean, the pictures that I took at Roslyn Chapel, just absolutely, I spent 5.5 hours in there. I took over 1,000 pictures. As I went through them, I was just, my jaw was on the floor the entire time. You know, of course, the building has been popularized by the movie The Da Vinci Code, but they completely missed the point in the movie. So going into Iraq and Iran, I think literally, although maybe part of fulfilling ancient prophecy, I think it has nothing to do with oil.
No. Well, when you look at Iraq and you ask the question, you know, why did we go there? I mean, the official reasons are pretty hollow.
They make good press, but I don't think that people are thinking far enough or grand enough. We're talking about the very survival of the human race.
Well, it's obvious that we didn't have good intelligence, so why did we go in?
Yeah, exactly.
There never were, and a simple guy like me, I called my staff together of about 10 people, and I had supported going into Afghanistan because I thought that we were able to connect the Al-Qaeda with what had happened at 9/11. And even though I'm not an anti-war and I'm not a pacifist, but I'm very reluctant. I think war is the last choice.
Sure.
But although I do believe in defense, but I was able to reluctantly support that. But when we started talking about going into Iraq, I got my staff together and I said, I assure you, with the intelligence that we have, this has not a thing to do with what we're saying. There are no weapons of mass destruction. Not going to find any weapons of mass destruction. And there was a lot of reasons why I said that. I know we're going to run out of time, so I won't go into all of that. But I've made the case to my staff that's not the case. So if that's not the case, then why did we go in? I mean, if we went there to take control of oil, why are we getting less now than before the invasion? If we went there to spread democracy, does anybody believe that we actually do that with the tip of a cannon barrel? And now, you look at the infrastructure. You know, we had said that all of the oil there was going to pay for all of the reconstruction. Well, what happened? Because, man, it's sitting there in disrepair. The only thing that we are finishing is the world's biggest military base and the world's biggest embassy. And that's all we're doing. And yet there were widespread reports. you're talking about going there and taking pictures. There were widespread reports, some of them from good intelligence officers, who said the very first thing we did was we went to the museums and we went to Saddam's mansions and we recovered certain artifacts. Things that we wanted that had been buried in the earth. And so it seems to me at least likely that we went into Iraq for reasons other than what was stated at the outset. I mean, I can buy maybe a piece of the idea that we went there as a strategic placement in the Middle East.
Let's take the last 15 minutes. We'll tie one final piece to this that I think is just really going to you'll see the ripples when I bring it up. The year 2012 is tied in with the Mayan calendar and very ancient technology that was used to make that calendar, namely the Tolkien wheels. It seems that even Jesus, when he talked about the end of the age, this is what he was talking about, the end of precession, the end of the cycle of the axis of the earth through the zodiac. It seems like all this is lining up, not just the quickening, the acceleration of earthquakes and volcanoes and superstorms and all these things, but there is an emotional, tangible, metaphysical peak that's being reached by the human race. And, you know, that leaves us, what, about 6.5 years before the, quote, end times predicted by the Mayans occurs. I think it goes without saying that cataclysmic precursors are accelerating in frequency and intensity. I guess my question is, do you see a cause and effect, or do you think the Goric gloom so deftly used by political parties is the true model we should be using?
Well, the thing with the year 2012, I'm probably kind of a new student to some of this whole idea about the Mayan calendar. But I know that, you know, in representative doctrine, in Hermetic doctrine, you've got these stargates that are positioned at the beginning and ending points of the sky, where you have the ecliptic, the pathway of the sun that's crossing the Milky Way.
Mm-hmm.
And around the world, including in Mayan thinking, there are this description that depicts the distance between those points as a snake that's encompassing the heavens. And often, beings are seen entering the mouth of this snake. It's something that's viewed maybe by some people as an ancient record of the arrival and the departure of these super intelligent beings using wormholes or stargate technology to navigate the heavens. In other renderings, however, there's this ladder that's seen descending from the ecliptic.
Right.
And it provides this connecting point between heaven and earth. And you're right, it's Hebrew too, Jacob's ladder, and other extra biblical accounts as well. But some scholars believe that the whole idea of teaching here in these gates of heaven is something that, what can I say? I mean, it was understood by even early Christians. You mentioned that you thought even what Jesus was talking about that might have been some reference to this. Saint Peter's appointment as the gatekeeper, maybe being a reference to that belief, the whole idea. In fact, there's statues of Peter that often show him holding these two keys, the keys to lower and heaven, lower and higher heaven, life and death, heaven and hell.
And there are ancient carvings in the Museum of Anthropology in Mexico City that actually depict a stargate through which a planet is coming. Or there's a picture of it in our second book. And one other thing, I've got a lot of contacts who are accomplished remote viewers, and they all have this sort of fog when it comes to seeing past this date. It's like, I don't know if it's forbidden, but it seems like the end is the beginning, or there's nothing past that. It just seems like all of this activity is tying together, not just the prophecies and predictions, but the signs of change.
Well, and so that one of the most important aspects of all of we've talked about tonight, you have this whole universal serpent, stargate, serpent saviors, stargate imagery that's connecting these ends of the Milky Way, and that somehow this has to do with the year 2012.
Like the Ouroboros.
The Ouroboros and the prophesied end of times, the reopening of this Mayan serpent portal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the end of the great cycle of the Mayan calendar and the planetary cycle of the Aztec calendar, and that and there are people who made this connection, the fact that that whole end date occurs at exactly 11:11, when the winter solstice and the galactic equinox occurs, and the solar system then aligns with the center of the galaxy, and it's an event horizon that's going to, that, well, first of all, it only happens, what, every 25,000 years, but it's a time that marks the end of not only the Mayan calendar, but it seems to be something that has been both talked about and foreseen, this whole idea, you know, whether it's Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, and some people think the feathers equate to flying technology, while serpent refers to that wormhole technology, descending through this hole in the sky on a rope ladder. There's another version of Quetzalcoatl where he's sailing down on a winged ship. But this date, 2012, where this serpent rope emerges again from the center of the Milky Way, and Quetzalcoatl returns at the end of time. It's just interesting when you, in comparative religions, how you see all this corresponding mythology, typology, legends from around the world combining this imagery of heavenly or elevated bearded gods and the beginning of creation and the ending of time based on the return of the One. Virtually all of these gods who sailed in a ship portrayed on a serpent moving across the waters of the sky, you know what I mean? And now, to be looking at all of this and approaching 2012 at a time where the prophets of the Bible also are saying that when we invade Iraq and we destroy Iraq, that God himself is going to command and these gates are going to open. And these super intelligent ones, these beings are going to return. I don't know. Look, the whole story, and here we are, we're in Iraq, the whole story of the Tower of Babel, whose builders, immediately after, the scripture says that Nimrod began to be, instantly, the next chapter, he wants to build the Tower of Babel. And why does he want to build the Tower of Babel? So its top will reach into Shamayim. This is the place where the ladder descends. This is the place where the gods came down and involved themselves with man. He wants to build a tower whose top is going to reach up in there. And he's going to take himself into the presence of God, Quetzalcoatl, of Christ. And the Lord comes down, according to the Bible, and he saw what was happening, and what did he say? Nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. That comment's curious. I mean, if the meaning there is only that the Tower of Babel would reach into the sky, I mean, there have been structures built around the world since the dawn of time that went up into the sky. But as far as I know, none of them ever caused the Creator to say, nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. They've found a location, they've built a tower, and its top will reach into Shamayim. Now, what was it that they imagined to do? Not only to build a top whose tower would reach into heaven. Ask yourself, I don't know how much time we got, it's probably not very much.
We have about 7 minutes.
Okay, ask yourself, how close to the surface of the earth is the dwelling place of angels, of demons, of God, of Quetzalcoatl? And I ask that because human nature tends to place, you know, the physical, for want of a better term, the physical location of these domains way out into outer space somewhere. But what if the heavens, what if the gateway, what if the opening is so close to the surface of the earth that it could be reached upon tall towers?
Yeah, all you need is a tower in a certain place, a ziggurat.
Well, and the Nephilim had intimate knowledge of the original earth before the heavens were closed up.
Sure.
Before the Creator no longer walked with man in the cool of the evening. So did the Nephilim, as offspring of those beings, did they know something about the periphery of the cosmos, of the throne room of the Creator that we don't know? Did they know that in some way those locations are just above the surface of our head? I mean, is that why holy people down through time have felt driven subconsciously to ascend mountains in search of God? Is that why scriptural and extra-biblical literature universally depicts metaphors of heaven attained upon elevated platforms, whether it's Jacob's ladder, Quetzalcoatl's ladder, the gods on the mountain of Olympus, the feet of the returning Christ upon the Mount of Olives, Moses receiving the law from God upon Sinai, the watchers descending upon Mount Hermon? Is that why Nimrod, who began to be a Geborim, decided to build a tower whose top would reach into Shemayim?
Is this why the two most volatile societies on our planet fight over exactly the same real estate?
Yeah, because without going into all of my thoughts about why we went there, do some research in the first inaugural speech where Bush twice referred to the angel in the whirlwind who directs the storm, which was a line from Joseph Addison's 1705 poem, The Campaign, which was quoted in John Page, who wrote to Thomas Jefferson, but these were adepts of esoteric ancient knowledge. I know we're out of time, so
these aren't so veiled, you know. Even some of the major addresses that have been made, the motif of the stage itself was set up in ancient Atlantean circle within a circle designs. A lot of this is not so veiled. It's out there for the aware to see. And I don't know. Well, I can't suppose that they'd be so intelligent as to hijack, you know, this kind of symbolism for their own purposes.
Well, I might.
Well, I think they're actually following a specific instruction by off-worlder Nephilim watchers who are here directing this level of activity on our planet.
Well, then you and I are on the same page, because I've done significant research into this administration, words mean things, and particularly when they're used in inaugural speeches.
Not a wasted syllable.
That's right. And I've done entire shows connecting the dots between, essentially the bottom line between what was said and why. You know, why would we be referring to the angel in the whirlwind, or Metatron, and the Kabbalah, things from both ancient esoteric knowledge and also the Kabbalah? The bottom line is, I know we're out of time, but the same angel of Bush's speech is from the Book of Enoch, who is the knower, the revealer of secrets, and to the Illuminati, the Moriah conquering wind, but also known as the brother of Ophon, which in Hebrew is the wheel you just referred to, as in the wheel in the middle of the wheel.
Yeah, it's old king wheels, the interlocking interdimensional timekeepers.
The literal chariot of God.
Absolutely.
And I guess then, Metatron, who is observed by various persons, including the Illuminati, as the keeper and giver of secrets, but who has a female equivalent, which is Shakana, the president's own title,
Shakana,
for our invasion of Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, depending on what we found there or why we went in, maybe you better have Metatron and Shakana on your side if you're going to disturb the grave of Nimrod, who built the Tower of Babylon in the ancient home of the Bab-Ili, the Gate of the Ili, the Illumined Ones, the Gate to God. In the Bible, this huge tower called in the Sumerian the Etamenenanki, the house of the foundation of heaven and earth. Maybe it makes perfect sense why we're there. We'll have to talk about that someday.
Yeah,
why we're in Babylon under the invitation of Metatron and Shakana and Moriah and Lilith and Molech and the powers of the air and the angels of the whirlwind. And I think this administration could have got us in trouble with more than what we can see with our eyes. It doesn't mean that we're doomed. but it does mean that it's very important who holds offices of power.
It certainly does. Certainly does. Well, my guest tonight has been Tom Horn. Absolutely fascinating 3 hours. I think we could have spent nine more, and I would love to invite him back if you'll accept. Don't forget to visit his websites, RaidersNewsUpdate.com and ArimanGate.com, and pick up his book, Ahriman's Gate. I'm going to pick it up myself just because we've had this discussion, and now I'm excited about it.
Well, and don't forget that I wrote it from a very biblical worldview. So it'll sound a whole lot like, other than being the kind of mind-controlling stuff you might see otherwise in evangelical Christianity, it'll sound a whole lot like some of the fundamentalist interpretations of the end times. I wrote it that way on purpose, but if you want to know more about who I am and what we do, you could just visit the RaidersNewsUpdate.com.
Well, I've visited it several times, and I couldn't absorb it all just in the few times that I went to it, and I can certainly see why it gets hundreds of thousands of hits a day. Envious to us all, to be sure. I want you to remember, Earth Explorers, who you are, that everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose every day. Remember, every life is immensely valuable. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. Now, this is X Squared Radio, and I'm Brooks Agnew saying peace, Earth Explorers, and good night. Good night, Tom.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.